my grandfather passed away, and I felt like I lost a part of myself I can't get back. I can't fix it. I can't mend it because they're not here anymore.
So, you know, I'm doing the thing that I love, yet I still felt, God, I feel like I've never felt more alone.
This protects you.
It does.
From being disappointed.
It is.
But it traps you.
Every day I feel like,
Jesus, this is...
might be my last.
Are you watching this feeling hopeless or broken? Are you doing all the right things but still feel deeply depressed? I'm John Regalado, and from Jubilee Media, this is Surrounded, featuring 20 people who are struggling with depression. Now, if you've seen the show before, you know it's built around debate. But today we're doing something different. This won't be a debate, and this time the flags won't be used to vote someone out of the circle.
I was gonna say, and then my dad died, and then my child died, and then my dog died. You've been voted out. Stop. You've been voted out. No more deaths. Sit the f*** down.
They'll signal your desire to speak with our featured guest, psychiatrist Dr. K. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you all for being here. We're very appreciative of you guys sharing your stories. Let's get into it.
Dan is seething right now, guys. Just kidding. Whoa!
This My first surrounded claim is you're not broken, you're overwhelmed.
One thing that Dr. K does when he talks to people that I think is actually so important, and I feel like a lot of people casually get this wrong, maybe medically we used to get this wrong and we changed or whatever, but there's a very fine line between trying to comfort somebody and like and doing a thing that just feels like you're downplaying everything that they have. So like somebody's like, oh, you know, like my cat died, I had a cat that was 18 years old and they just died, and then the person's like, well, you know, your cat's in a better place now, you'll probably see them when you cross the rainbow road, and you know it, you know, and it's like, okay, I guess. But you're just like, okay, yeah, me, I guess. Me, you know what? You're right. I'm going to go kill myself right now to go find my cat. Me, I guess. My bad, you know? But there's something that feels wrong about, like, telling somebody that, like, oh, yeah, like, your cat died. That does suck. That's really sad. That must be terrible, right? But sometimes hearing that, having somebody reflect that back at you, I think it feels good. Dr. K is really good at that, usually, I think, yeah.
Hey, what's your name?
My name's C.
C?
Yeah, C.
It's just
nice
time,
to meet you. Nice to meet you. So I'm a former foster kid, and for all my life, I've lived differently from everyone else, essentially from surviving. I wasn't taught normal societal like behaviors or emotions.
This is like a crazy like concept for an episode. Jesus.
Because I had to take care of myself while being in a dangerous environment. And what's interesting is that even though physically and mentally I'm fine and I feel great and I can do my daily tasks, interact with people, it's still stuck in my body. I feel the depression, like right now, I don't want to cry, but for some reason, my body just wants to let it out. And before, I wouldn't let it because growing up in a Hispanic culture, they'd be like, oh, porque te lloras? Like, why are you crying? Like, you want to cry? Okay, I'll make you cry. To where it was like, okay, like, I can't. But the more that I would hold it in and push it down, the worse it became until eventually I just let it out. It's like my nervous system and my mind are completely separate.
Yeah.
And they're going into different things to where my body doesn't recognize that I'm safe. Like now I'm safe. No one's going to hurt me. No one's coming after me. No one's going to physically or emotionally hurt me. But my body is still in that hypervigilant state. It's where it's always aware. It's always like, okay. And there are times where it just becomes overwhelming. There are times where it looks like disassociation, night terrors, to where it feels like it's hard to trust or connect with people. It's feels like I'm still in that like physical state, whereas like mentally I'm great. I just don't know how to. I've gone through the work. I go through depression. I'm taking antidepressants. I'm taking like multiple classes and courses and therapies. But I just want to understand why this happens so much. Why is it that my body reacts so differently from my brain?
So the first thing we're going to talk about is dissociation. You have two parts of your brain, two hemispheres. Your right hemisphere is where we experience emotions. Your left hemisphere is where we're basically logical. I mean, that's not necessarily true, but it broadly is true. Now, here's the really interesting thing. In the middle, there's this part of our brain called the corpus callosum. And the corpus callosum is what lets the right part of our brain talk to the left part of our brain. And when people grow up in a very traumatic environment, that thing stops communicating. You may experience that everything is fine. Mm-hmm. The left side of your brain, which is active right now, is saying, okay, we're at work. We're maybe like going to go get some ice cream after work. And you're like living a normal life. But the other half of your brain is screaming. And the problem is the volume has been turned down so we can't hear it. Or the headphones are unplugged. So even though the signal is there, this part of your brain is screaming, the left side of your brain doesn't really feel it. Except there are times where it switches over. And then we feel all of these weird emotions. Like we feel all these emotions that we had no idea like where this is coming from. Feels really inappropriate because I'm like sitting here having my ice cream and my body is telling me like, oh my God, we're gonna die or something like that, right? So this is a really, really classic situation. I think a big part of this, and the good news is that we can heal from this. What's really hard about this is how confusing it is. Because you see like other people react appropriately to the things that happen around them. But literally what's happened is you have all of these pent up reactions that you've been carrying with you. And I can see that this is bringing up. What are you feeling?
I don't know what it is. It's just kind of just what I do is I don't even just let it out. It's as if my body wants to cry, but I'm listening to you and I'm not crying, but my body is.
Yeah. See, it's happening right now. And so what when you feel this way, what do you do?
Before it used to be really bad where I would like hit my forearm or hit myself and be like, no, you can't
also
feel this
common way.
To where now I've learned that I let it be, let it process. You know, if I'm going to cry, it's like I even close my eyes and I go, it's okay, you're safe. No one's going to hurt you. You just breathe and I just let it out, because the more I let it out, the more I let it be, then it kind of goes through this like stress cycle and I'm able to like be myself again. And then after that, I go hang out with friends. I go outside, touch grass. It's the touch, sight, smell, and feel that I do to kind of be present.
You figured all this stuff out on your own?
Yes.
This is amazing. Yeah, I think what's so sad about this is just how much of this should have been done for you. I think people don't realize this. The way that we manage our emotions is through other people.
Mm-hmm.
Even now, you're sort of like a foster kid surviving on your own, right? And this is a situation where I think like the healthiest thing is that someone else should actually handle that emotion for you. That you shouldn't have to deal with this all on your own and cope with it. And that you should be able to cry and get angry and things like that, right?
Yeah.
So like what a parent does when a kid is like 3 years old and they're learning how to cry, which you haven't been able to do because of what seems like some amount of Hispanic upbringing, foster care, things like that.
Yeah. Whoa. My parents didn't like me because I was gay. So they kept me away from society, kept me away from people.
Yeah.
Like they had me essentially say, you were essentially a demon. So you need to stay in this area. And this is how you should act and be. You are quiet. You are
so messed up.
So that's what I've learned. And now I'm trying to readapt to it. And the biggest thing is feeling my emotions. Like this I can control. This, like, it's so hard.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a modality called EFT, which is called the emotional freedom technique. There's a lot of studies now that show that trauma is stored in the body. And I think that these reactions that you're having where you feel like your body wants to cry and your mind doesn't, like that's where like literally stuff is stored, is pent up. And I think it's got to come out. And I think the most important thing, I know this sounds crazy, but I think the most important thing is trying to find someone who will deal with it for you, because you've dealt with it on your own for like far too long.
So what does that look like then?
It's a great question. Sometimes this can be a therapist. Sometimes it can be a friend. I think it can look a lot of different ways. Tragically, you were not given that growing up. And I think this is one of the saddest things in psychiatry, how insufficient treatment is a substitute for love. And I think like love really goes a long way.
Yeah. That, and for me, it looks like actions too.
Yeah.
Thank you, C. We're going to pause here and switch participants.
One of the, I'm not saying anything about her in particular because I don't know her story or what her life is like or anything, but something that's really scary is I notice this sometimes when I'm doing like my manifestos or when I'm trying to like investigate something, is if you get the story of a thing stuck in your mind, it can be very easy to see a whole bunch of confirming evidence, and it could be very easy to discredit a bunch of stuff that you feel is disconfirming. But the reality is you're not actually building a good story. You just have this like skeletal structure in your mind, and it's very easy to build on that if that's all you're looking for. One of the things is a little bit scary when people start to learn the psych language is I worry sometimes that the person is losing the ability to accurately understand what's going on or figure out how to make improvements on it, because they're like lost in the, they found like the pattern online and then they can speak in and in, interpret everything through like whatever psych paradigm they've learned. I feel like that could be really bad sometimes, but.
Before I call the next person, can we fly in maybe some tissues if people need them? Raise your hand if you need to grab a couple.
I brought one. I can't prepare.
That's okay.
May need more than one.
All right. Maybe everybody just take like one cleansing breath. I know.
Sorry if this is hard hitting, but what symptoms did you see in Reckful in his life? Reckful to me came off as just completely like major depressive disorder and like bipolar, I guess, or whatever. I don't know fucking what the diagnosis would be, but like Reckful's baseline day-to-day experience was not survivable. His mental state was too... it was too devoid of any happiness, his default mental state, which is why he's using a ton of drugs and going after crazy experiences to try to bring that baseline up, or not bring the baseline up, but to try to like fight to get above that bad baseline. And then the second issue was, I think he had some kind of bipolar, like, or well, I say depression, I guess maybe it's just bipolar. He would be extremely manic. I remember somebody linked earlier a tweet where he proposed to Becca on Twitter. His manic phases were pretty crazy. His depressive phases were very crazy. Or not good. So he was not good. Not good.
It's energy to listen. It takes energy to share. But thanks everybody for the generosity. All right. I'm going to choose the next participant. Leah, I saw your flag up. You ready to go? Let's do it.
Hi.
I'm Leah.
Leah Olok. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Well, I just wanted to, for one, say that I've related to things that both of these people have been saying before me. First, in the grief, my dad passed away 6 years ago. That has been a significant source of my depression. And I have treatment-resistant depression, but it's not for the lack of wanting to be treated. I would do anything for something that works, but like nothing has. Like, it's like my mind is, I feel like, is searching for more reasons to be depressed sometimes. And also I relate to the dissociation. Like, half of me is like somewhere and the other half is like super depressed. So for example, I'm a musician, and how I cope is actually writing about this really deep, dark stuff, like suicidality and stuff. I write about that. I was at a show and the show was going objectively really well. Sorry. Yeah, I just looked out at the, sorry, I don't even know why I'm crying right now. Objectively, everything was good. I just looked out at the crowd, I felt so empty. So, you know, I'm doing the thing that I love. Yet I still felt, God, I feel like I've never felt more alone. Sorry, yeah. I did not expect to cry.
Can I respond?
Yeah, yes, yeah. Please.
So, thank you so much for sharing. What was your name again?
I'm Leah.
Leah. Here's what I'm hearing. So here you are.
Jesus. Is that Lab's name?
Or you make music. You use it to cope.
Yeah. But
do you feel like all of these people are genuinely ill? I don't like, it's hard to say who is or who isn't. It's hard to, without knowing more of their story, and then even without knowing what it even means to be. So it's like really difficult. I don't know. Like, there are some people where I'm like, this motherfucker's faking or whatever, but I don't think anybody I've heard up here speak sounds like they're just like, I don't know what you would call it, attention seeking or whatever. I don't know. None of these so far.
I imagine you like it too.
Yeah, of course.
Right? And you're on stage. You're actually like kind of at the height of joy and fulfillment in your life. Like, this is what you came here to do.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm not exactly where I want to be yet.
I'm sure that there's, you know, stuff that can be better. But if we think about, you know, just the moments of joy.
Yeah.
And you're denied that.
Yeah. It's like things are starting for me. And then why am I still not?
Yeah. Right. So I'm almost like thinking about how hard it must be for the things in life that are supposed to feel really good.
Yeah.
To feel so alone.
Yeah.
Right. And I really hear that you've got treatment resistant depression. And yeah. I hear that if anything could take this feeling away, right. If anything would just allow you to experience life the way that regular human beings do, which is like when I'm on stage and having a good time and everyone's singing lyrics, I should be having a good time too.
Yeah.
And that feels really, really terrible.
Yeah.
Like, you're being denied the chance to live an ordinary life.
Yeah. That's sort of like why it's so bad.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. How do you understand that your mind is searching for reasons to be unhappy?
Well, I'm super judgmental of myself. So my self-talk is like very negative. I'm sort of like at a constant like argument with myself. So it's like, but I'm also like, I know that I have to like accept these thoughts and not argue with them to give it, like, I know the solution on paper. It's just harder to apply in practice. For example, again, the stage thing, like, I'm doing what I love, right? Why is my brain, it feels like it's like looking for reasons to be upset.
So here's one of the tricky things I've learned as a psychiatrist, and I've worked a fair amount with people with treatment-resistant depression. Speaking of humility, I think there's three patients that I've worked with that I really have not been able to help that I can think of, and I remember them very well, and we tried really hard, and I think I hate that. But
what do you do about something like that?
I mean, tried all kinds of things, but I think the good news is that, you know, for the three patients that I've worked with who have treatment-resistant depression, I've worked with 50 to 75, that things have worked. And the one thing that I would really tunnel down into, just because we have a little bit of time here, is to really pay attention to that part that is searching for a reason to be unhappy. So don't argue against yourself, but try shifting your attention away from that towards other things.
Yeah, definitely tried.
And I think that's a skill.
And sometimes it works.
Right. So if it works sometimes, then that's where I think learning to be better at it can offer some relief.
It's just the fact that it always goes back.
That's where we get to part number two.
Okay.
Which is to understand why your mind, there's a part of your mind that is really, really unhappy with being happy.
Yeah.
Right? The most alone that you felt is when you are actually should be the happiest.
Yeah.
And so to really understand What is it within you that is looking for unhappiness?
We're gonna pause here. Leah, thank you. We're gonna switch participants.
Good luck, Leah.
Thank you.
Time moves fast, but your credit score doesn't have to stay stuck. I remember how
Thank
overwhelmed
God.
I felt
this
trying
is what
to fix
I
my
need.
Credit. It felt like a catch-22.
A credit card. Credit Hell credit. Yes.
Then I found Kickoff. Signing.
Hold on, real quick. Somebody linked this. What is this? Freaked out on my ex publicly. Oh, can I do a meme? I'm going to get hate for this, and I don't give a f-. I have the same feeling about cheeseburgers, okay? You don't get points for this. You don't get points for making the largest, most massive, huge burrito. You ever get burrito? You ever get a burrito chode? You ever get a burrito chode where it's like, oh, my burrito is 4 inches long. And like, what are you supposed to do with that? Every time I go to a place, and I want to just sit at the table and just smash it into my face and then just sit there until they tell me to leave. What? It's just so obnoxious. It's just so obnoxious. What, like, oh, let me take a bite from the corner. Mmm, I sure do like my rice burrito. Let me take a bite from up here. Mmm, I sure do like my carne asada burrito. Mmm, let me take a bite from over here. Mmm, just a whole bite of guacamole. So good. What the f***? What am I supposed to do with this? Anyway. Farmer's Market Burrito and Latte. Saw a guy was in a weird, intense situationship, off and on again, sometimes relationship with, for a year and a half at a bar with someone new and freaked out on him the other night. Just can't get over all the horrible nights he put me through, lying, being stood up. The time he went to another woman's house in the middle of the night, he invited me too, and generally being treated as convenience for him. I should have left, but instead I chose to scold him in front of this woman in the middle of the bar and then send him a bunch of angry text messages afterwards. Now I've spent all weekend burning with humiliation and shame for saying the things I said out of anger, mostly regarding how he treated me, but some of it was about his habits and him as a person. But what can you do when you always look crazy other than just disappear? I just wanted someone to love me, and I got someone who sort of hated me for a year and a half, and the anger feels unending, but now I look insane to him and his friends and the woman he was with. The reason why these situations, not to be mean, okay? Remember, we hate men here, okay? I hope that guy posts my subreddit again about it. But if a woman is in a situationship where she's using sex to get the guy to pay attention to her, and the guy's in a situationship where he's dangling a relationship to get the woman to f*** him, you are both mutually manipulating each other. The reason why it feels weird as the woman here for shouting at him or scolding him is because you're doing about the same as he's doing. You just incur a bit more social damage for it. But, like, that's really all that's happening, okay? Stop doing this. Stop. Stop it on both sides, all right?
Cleanup took minutes on my
phone. Anyway, back to our
credit check and no hidden fees. For users with credit under 600, they see an average growth of 86 points. Kickoff helps you score big when it comes to credit. Plans start at just $5 a month with zero interest. Start building credit with Kickoff today and get your first month for as little as $1. That's 80% off the normal price when you go to getkickoff.com/surrounded today.
That's
Kickoff without the C.
Based.
Get kickoff.com/surrounded.
Yes. Okay, what year is it? We can speed up audio without increasing the pitch. There's no reason for it to sound like this. Stop.
OFF.com/surrounded.
Must sign up via kickoff.com/surrounded to activate offer. Offer applies to new Kickoff customers first month only. Subject to approval, offer subject to change. Average first year credit score impact plus 86 points between August 24 and August 25. For Kickoff credit card users who started with a score below 600, paid on time and who had no delinquencies or collections added to their credit profile during the period. Late payments can negatively impact credit score. Individual results may vary.
Thank you to Kickoff for sponsoring this episode. Now let's get back to the show.
My next surrounded claim is that hopelessness feels like a conclusion, but it's actually a symptom.
Joseph, would you like to be our first participant? All right, head to the center.
Hey, Joseph.
Hi, Dr. K. How are you doing today?
Good.
Good to meet you.
Nice to meet you, man. Well, does hopelessness feel like a conclusion to you?
That's part of my issues is that when I am super depressed and I'm at the depths of everything, that's where...
Whoa! Older white guy.
It feels like there's no way out. And so is this a symptom of something that's bigger or is this my final state? And so that's where...
I hate, and I will always hate this. None of the psychiatric disorders, none of them should have words that are common parlance. I think it has destroyed our ability to talk about a lot of stuff. Sometimes people are incredibly sad and they need actual serious help to get through this sadness. Sometimes people have whatever the f- conditions are that, you know, would lead to major depressive disorder. The fact that we just say depression or sadness or anxiety, and we use these words both in common parlance and in like disorder diagnoses, I think is incredibly harmful and damaging. I don't know. Like, imagine if every time somebody was anxious, they were like, I'm hypertensive right now. I think my blood pressure is high right now. Like, imagine they said this, it would just be, it's just such a clusterfuck. It's so, ugh.
I get stuck because I know that it's a symptom, but the overwhelming thought is like, this is my conclusion. This is where I'm stuck and there is no escaping this. That's where I feel like I can't gain the traction, even though I know I'm supposed to, and I have the skills and I've met doctors and worked on this. I don't know how to get past that. So I get bogged down that I'm stuck here.
Yes. So this seems really hard because it sounds like you actually know on some level that this is a symptom.
Yes.
You've worked with doctors, you've learned the skills in your head. You're telling yourself, oh, this is just this.
Would you be okay with it if people didn't misuse the terms? Well, I don't even necessarily think it's intentional. I just think it's very hard sometimes. If you haven't experienced a mental disorder, it's hard to know if you actually have it. And I don't fault people for thinking one way or the other. It's just really hard to know. How do you know if you're crazy, or how do you know if you're depressive? Because we can't really communicate the experiences to other people. And sometimes I feel like using words in common parlance, I think, confuses that a bit, you know?
Symptom. This is not a conclusion. You try to disbelieve yourself.
Yeah, like dissociation is a term I hear used a lot. But also, like, I don't want to fucking gatekeep anything. But like, I don't know. I had after my mushroom trip for about a year, I had a bunch of weird shit going on. I had periods of like dissociation, and in my mind, dissociation is just totally different from like spacing out or not wanting to be in a place. These two things are not even remotely related. But I could see how like, if somebody's shouting at me, or even if I'm like nervous or anxious and I kind of don't want to be in an area and I'm just kind of like, whatever. Like, that in my mind, that has nothing to do with dissociation. It's a totally different thing. But like, maybe some people's experiences are closer together. I don't know. Or maybe when other people are describing it, they are actually describing the one feeling, what I would map onto dissociation, but they're just, the way they describe it is just not how I would describe it. Like, it's hard to, I don't know. But then I also, because when I was trying to read about these things, like I see sometimes dissociation and depersonalization and derealization sometimes get all jumbled together, even though people have like different words for them sometimes, or I'm sorry, even though people have different definitions for each word. I don't know. How would you describe it? Well, my feelings also might be related just because it was a horrible mushroom trip. So maybe that was why, maybe my personal experience with it was different. For me, it would usually just be me sitting in a place, and all of my mental revolved around this, but just like kind of like feeling everything was just like a bit not real, or that I shouldn't be in a particular area, or that things just didn't quite make sense. So I would have to go outside. I would have to like look at stuff to feel like this was like a real thing and that I kind of like belonged here and this was all like kind of real. These feelings would always come after a panic attack for me. Yeah, they would hit, and they would hit like very, very, very strong. Like this feeling of like, ooh, like something. This is just not like, I don't know. But maybe there are different ways. I don't know. Yeah, it sucks. It's annoying. We should be able to. What I'm saying is, we need Neuralink from Elon Musk to translate the brain for us. Okay. Did Reckful make your shroom trip worse? I mean, probably, but I don't like a lot of people shitting on him on the comments on that video or in general. Like, I was asking for it. I told him, like, I just want the worst mushroom trip possible. Let's go. Because I didn't think that it would actually do anything. I just didn't believe that. I thought it was, like, elbow drugs. Like, nothing's going to happen. So, I mean, like, yeah, it was horrible. But, I mean, like, I kind of asked for it. So, I mean, like, it's not, like, his fault.
You're telling yourself, oh, this is just a symptom. This is not a conclusion. You try to disbelieve yourself.
Right.
And then what happens?
Well, then that's where I've made more progress. I'm not as stuck as I was, and thankfully. But I still have to work on this all the time. It never goes away. And I wax and I wane. So when I'm feeling like I can't gain traction to get out of here and I don't know what my next steps are, it gets so scary that it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. I can feel it dragging me backwards. And that led to ultimately to some very, very deep depressions, suicide attempt, the loss of my employment.
That is the problem. People equate acute sadness with an exogenous cause like depression, and they are explicitly different phenomenon. Yeah, maybe they are, but also like maybe they're not. I'm not sure. Like anxiety for me was like really weird because sitting in some place and then just starting to have anxiety was like really not cool for me, because generally any stressor in my life is exogenous. Like I know why somebody's, you know, tweeting about me or something is happening, or it's like, okay, but having nothing happening and then feeling bad is like, wait, what the f-? But then also like, and this is hard. This is why it's so important to have a friend if you have like mental health related stuff, even though it seems like nothing outside is affecting you. If you have a friend or somebody, or if you can do it yourself, like pushes you like, hey, let's go on a walk, let's go outside, or let's do something else. in my personal experience and from other people I've heard, maybe not universally, but like this will boost your mood. You will start to feel a little bit better, assuming this isn't going to like cure your depression, is to walk outside. But at the very least, it'll change like what's going on. Or at least in my experience, it does. I know it does when you're on trips, but.
And so that didn't help, you know?
Yeah. So what I'm kind of getting the sense of is that you'll struggle for a while, but then it feels like inevitably you're going to get dragged down.
Right. When I feel like I'm dragging myself backwards and I'm never going to get out of this. And it's like, oh no, here we go again.
Can I ask you, when you say I'm dragging myself backwards?
Yes.
What is that? Help me understand why you think it's you who's doing the dragging.
Well, that's my inner struggle, your inner voice talking with you. It's like, well, you know better. You know that this is going to hurt, you know, and that this is something that is bad for you to bed rot, to doom scroll, to just feel hopeless. I feel disappointed in myself because I feel like I know better.
Would you say that disappointed is almost like self-loathing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
How do you relate to that loathing feeling that you have towards yourself?
So what happens when that starts to happen is I perseverate on all the issues. I lost my job. I disappointed my family. I lost my identity. Being a fireman, I mean, firemen are very wrapped up in their profession. That becomes part of their identity. Fortunately, I tried to avoid that, but it still grabbed me. So that just really weighs heavy on my mind because I look at all the things that I destroyed or gave up.
So this is what's so tricky, right? Because what I'm noticing is that not only do you have the symptoms of depression, you actually have something else on top of that, which is a lot of blame for being depressed.
Yes.
After all, you put in the work. You tried everything, right? And it's a skill. And every day is, oh my God, it's like every day is a struggle. Every day is right. A struggle. Do you ever kind of tell yourself if you were different or if I did things better, then like all of this stuff would be working better?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So let me ask you this, Joe. I don't know if this makes sense. There's the depression that you feel, and then there's the way that you argue with yourself about the depression.
Yeah.
The way that you judge yourself for having the depression. What I think is really interesting is that's what's keeping it alive. Do you kind of get that?
Yes, absolutely.
Isn't it inappropriate to do public therapy like this? He is not doing therapy. These are just conversations, okay?
Absolutely, and I've worked on that with my doctors. You know, one of the things that my doctor and I used to talk about is I feel like what worked for me to get traction going was I was going to fake it till I make it. I'm going to act like I'm happy until I'm acting happy, you know?
Okay.
So I find myself feeling like if I don't do that, I'm just going to continue to beat myself up and it's just going to keep going and going and going. And I'm never going to make any progress.
There's a lot of studies on something called behavioral activation,
mm-hmm.
which we think that we have to feel better in order to do more, right? I want to feel better so I can get out of bed.
Right.
Whereas there's a lot of evidence that shows that sort of faking it till you make it actually works pretty well. That when we step out of bed, when we force ourselves out of bed, the feedback that we get can actually be helpful. So I can totally see why that has been.
It's so hard to do like fake it till you make it is either the best thing ever, because when you put yourself in these situations, you get the external feedback you need in order to stimulate yourself to make good choices. But other times fake it until you make it can mean you are pushing everything down. You're not engaging in a healthy manner with issues that you have. And then you just end up accumulating and accruing more and more baggage and issues until you self-destruct. You have to be able to figure out which one you're doing.
Helpful for you.
Yeah.
I think the thing that scares me the most and feels so oppressive, Joe, sitting with you is that just how much you have to work to have a normal day.
Oh yeah, absolutely, you know? Absolutely.
And I think that's where it's not so much about dealing with the depression and getting out of bed. It's really changing the way that you relate to your depression. That
one of the worst things that you will never be able to understand, and it's good that you can't understand it because it's the worst feeling ever. I explained this before, is that like our normal day-to-day experience, assuming nothing is happening, is good. It's not normal, it's not neutral, and it's not definitely not bad, but it's generally good. You're happy to wake up and be alive. You've got some things that you look forward to. Even if it's annoying, like going to work, there's employees, like your day-to-day experience is like, because you want to live. You don't want to die. You want to like live. That's the thing that you want. When your day-to-day experience starts dropping below that neutral line, where imagine like every single day you wake up and there's like a test that you weren't ready for. Every single day you wake up and you have like a new pain in your body that you know is never going to go away. And then you have the knowledge of knowing that every single day you wake up, it is always going to be like that. And there might be things that you can do to fight to bring it back to neutral or good, but you have to put in the work to do that. Most people don't have to work to just like feel like goodish like every day. Like that's just a like normal thing. And then you kind of like start from there. Starting from below neutral is not good. That's a horrifying experience.
This is something that sometimes happens.
Humans adapt to their circumstances really well though, no? I think normal human healthy brains do, yes, because of that. Our general baseline is like you want to live and survive and be happy. Like you have that drive in you. But when that goes away, then shit gets not good.
It's really changing the way that you relate to your depression. That this is something that sometimes happens to me for whatever reason. I'm cursed in this way, which I know sounds crazy, but right. Sometimes it can be useful to even think about it like that.
Right.
But ultimately changing that self-loathing is going to be a huge step forward.
Yeah. Pause here. Joe, thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks for thank you so much. Appreciate that.
Thank you for sharing your story.
Lamar.
Also, it is funny that like seeing like an older white guy here is like, why is this guy here? This is not like the normal psycho or not psychotherapist. This isn't the normal like psychology person at all. Like you expect to see younger people. I think he is in the demographic of people that like by and large commit suicide more than any other demographic. I think it's usually middle-aged, like 40 to 60-year-old white men. I don't remember the reasons why, but it's because of like empty nest or divorced or whatever else, but they're like the overrepresented in suicidality or suicides.
I saw you with your flag up. You want to go to the center?
That's why it's important to have these conversations. Yeah, but I feel like people don't talk much about middle-aged white guy issues because it's just not, well, one, it's a demographic of people that just don't talk about their feelings much. And then, no, it's mainly that. And they're not like super online. And so you just don't really see it much. It's kind of an invisible problem.
Hey, how are you? What's your name, bro?
Lamar.
Lamar? Oh, look. Thank you for coming up.
No problem.
Yes, like Jordan Peterson. My personal theory is that I think that this sounds so sad and mean just because of who Jordan Peterson is and what he came to represent. But like, I don't think there's anything wrong with being sensitive as a man. I don't even know actually if I would say Jordan Peterson is sensitive, but I don't think Jordan Peterson could handle the amount of hate online. When I look at what Jordan Peterson did as a teacher, and then when I think about what he did as a career, which I think was coaching, I think it was mainly women for like career advice and like furthering their life. My guess is going to be that Jordan Peterson probably was almost universally loved in his life. I seriously doubt there were a lot of people that were on him. His classroom lectures seemed genuinely interesting and riveting. It seemed like he engaged well with the material. His speeches were cool. His coaching service must have been really fulfilling for women. And to go from that to just having so much online, I bet that to some extent that mentally destroyed him. Like if you trace that path and then you see that he got like addicted to benzos, that's like not surprising at all in my mind, which is sad because a person like him could never really talk about experiencing that anxiety because it makes you a pussy or whatever else. And yeah, that's my guess is that's kind of what tore him apart, unfortunately. But yeah, I don't like that I started this off by saying he would be sensitive. I think a lot of people would have issues with things that people have to deal with online.
I would say that
basically what I'm trying to say is trans people are the problem and they kill Jordan Peterson. Just kidding.
For me, I can't speak as to everybody's journey or where they've been in life. But as far as for me, I feel like this is like the conclusion. A little bit of background on me, I'm a Marine. So I've been in...
Hold on. Does he not sound a little bit like Kendrick?
For me, I can't speak as to everybody's journey or where they've been in life. But as far as for me, I feel like this.
Somebody that's rich or somebody that.
No, his voice is higher. Voice is
really a poem. I just felt like
Kendrick's voice is
probably could relate to. Other than that, now that I finally got a chance to holler at you.
This is like the conclusion.
Never mind. Kendrick's voice is way higher. Just kidding. Forget that.
A little bit of background on me. I'm a Marine.
Well, no, you know what? I'd give it the 50-50.
So I've been in major conflicts. I've trained people for conflicts and everything.
He has the same cadence? Maybe.
Being in those conflicts, I only had a week on how to adjust to being a civilian again. After that week, I started sleeping in the closet for 6 months. Had all my meals given to me in the closet. Because I couldn't deal with anything out there. Thinking that after serving my country for 8 years, that I would come back to opportunities, jobs. I came back to a park bench that I slept on.
You say it's because they don't talk about it. I think it's more apt to say most people don't care about it. There are plenty of social issues that are out groups champion. No, I think if they talked about it, I think people would care about it. Do you have any experience or understanding with meditation or the ideas around it, like detachment? You seem very centered, like you naturally have it. I don't know if anybody would naturally have anything related to meditation stuff. I should try or do some of that. Everything I see written about and talked about for meditation seems like really good. I don't have the time in my life. I should. I would recommend exploring it because I feel like I see so much positive stuff about it. But
so I feel like I was kind of like left behind.
You were.
I was left behind. Yeah. I've accepted everything that I've done. As far as like my career over there, and it haunts me a lot of things, you know, it's taken over my life. When I got out, it feels like it's a starter package. I would talk to a mental health specialist. They would hear the problem. And then it's like they put you in a category and be like, all right, here's your trazodone. Here's your olazepine. Go out the door. Here you go. If I tell you that doesn't work, then it was given to me like I was the problem. It almost seems like I was getting penalized. for the medication not working.
Absolutely, right? So I'm getting the sense that you sort of got judged, that you were supposed to be a certain way. You were supposed to respond. You were supposed to get better. And you didn't get better.
No.
And then they label you, they bucket you, they put you on this track, it almost feels like.
Yes.
Yeah, so what's that like for you?
Well, that's why I say it feels like a conclusion, because after that doesn't work, my only question is, what's next? I've done the meditations, self-help, believe in yourself, you know, go to groups, do this, do that. I've done all that. And still I'm left with the same conclusion that it doesn't work.
So Lamar, I mean, I think what's really challenging about this is clearly something is left over from your time in the Marines, right? You're not the same person who went over. I don't know where you were, but does that kind of make sense?
Yes.
And then when you came back, they said, okay, for people who aren't able to integrate, take Trazodone, take Loxapine. Those are heavy hitting medicines, by the way. And then if you don't get better, then do this, then do this, then do this, then do this. And you're a guy who tried it all. It sounds like
you're talking about mental health prior to becoming a public figure. Fuck no. My mind is a fortress.
Tried meditation. I'm sure you've tried therapy.
I tried everything.
And if I were to tell you, Lamar, there is something that will help you. There's something that'll help you a lot. How would you receive that?
I think that at that point, after being through everything I've been through, I would have to put you in a category, because I would ask you, is it medication? It's going to be group therapy. It's going to be constantly checking in. Like, I haven't seen anything different across the board is what I'm trying to say.
Great. So good. Yeah. So now we have a different kind of problem,
okay,
which is that you have learned that something won't work.
I think I was taught that something would work all this time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Yeah. Lamar, I think the problem here is that the reason nothing is working is because I don't think anyone has really understood what you struggle with.
So where do we go from here?
We understand you, man. We understand what's it like. Why were you in the closet?
Because just a little bit of history, just real quick.
Yeah.
I did everything in reversal. I graduated from high school in 2003. Going through a recession in Dallas, Texas, there was no jobs. I was working warehouses at the time. 3 years later, after the contract, I go into the Marine Corps. And then I take 3 tours. My job description changed from heavy mechanics and helicopters to now I'm 03 infantry, heavy machine gunner. Then I switch again to intel. Now I'm doing interrogations throughout the night. And these interrogations ain't no one.
Yeah.
But I'm also telling my
commander. Who the f*** got an alarm going off? What? Hello?
And these interrogations ain't no one.
Yeah.
But I'm also telling my command I'm tired. I'm tired. They're thinking physically. I'm talking mentally.
Yeah, so let me say this, Lamar. What you
hear about this Rand Paul and Ron Johnson shit about prosecuting Fauci? Yeah, it's a disgusting, horrible crime, but what are you going to do? Were you affected by the recession? Kind of, yeah. The casino that I worked at, I have such a small engagement. I graduated high school in 2007. I was working at McDonald's, and then I was working at the casino through 2008. Once the recession hit, they wrecked all of our... No 401k matches. Our annual bonuses went from I think it was 5 to 8%, and then they scaled those down to 1 to 3%. And then I remember our lunchroom. They used to have they would serve all hot food or whatever, became sandwiches for the year. They shafted the out of us, okay? That. And the worst part is, okay, if I can impart one real life to my normie wage slaves out there. Holy shit. Okay. If you ever take any piece of real life advice from me, okay? When corporate starts taking shit away from you, you can't continue. You got to fuck the job up, even if you have to sabotage it. Get that CIA manual and sabotage it. Because when corporate sees that your environment can function with fewer resources than they thought possible, you're thinking in your mind, whew, I can't wait till we get through this. Man, I can't wait till they hire somebody else. Man, I can't. And they're thinking, well, these motherfuckers have had it good. Why the fuck did we even have this many employees on this? Why the fuck did we even give these guys? You guys are doing fine or whatever, you know? And they might even throw some small bonus at you or whatever. Meanwhile, you're collectively doing 1.5 employees worth of work. Be careful with that one. Be careful with that one, okay?
Whew. Shared with us. I cannot stress this enough.
That's when the... When the staffing stops, okay, the micro looting starts. That's what I'm saying, all right? You know what you got to do in a video game.
Profoundly affects every dimension of who you are.
Although I say that, but now if you would protest, they'd probably just AI replace you anyway. So fuck it.
Affects your heart, affects your lungs, affects your cortisol level, affects your mind, affects the way that you cope with things.
Could you clean your own carpet if you wanted to? No, you can't do anything from the job world in the real world because you have real-ass machinery there, bro. I could cook you 400 steak breakfast with everything flawless on my own on a shift, okay? If you put me in front of a huge-ass flat top, you know, four pans on a massive grill, not a grill. What the fuck are the flames on the stove? Is it just a stove? And then the huge grill with the hamburgers and the chicken and the steak. I can do all that shit. But then like a pan on a, your burners, whatever. But like pans on a induction stovetop with the, it's different, okay? You can still do it, but I'm just saying I feel like sometimes the job skills don't carry over all the time into real life. For carpet cleaning, I mean, if you give me a truck with a massive truck mount motor and a 100 gallon tub of water and then like the wands and the cleaning supplies, everything, I could do it. But like, I don't know what the f- I'm going to do in my ordinary house. I just get a rag with some water on it.
Stress this enough profoundly affects every dimension of who you are. Affects your heart, affects your lungs, affects your cortisol level, affects your mind, affects the way that you...
Steak for breakfast? Yeah, sorry. Unset username in YouTube chat. I see that we have a European that stumbled into here. Yeah, I'm American. We do eat steak for breakfast sometimes, motherfucker.
Who you are. Affects your heart, affects your lungs, affects your cortisol level, affects your mind, affects the way that you cope with things, affects the way that you survive.
Sorry, fuck, hold on. Destiny, did you see the study from MIT showing that automation has been systematically used to reduce wages, not improve efficiency? I hate to break this to you, buddy, but that is improving efficiency. Even if the job is slightly done worse, if they massively save on labor, they're making more money based on the amount of money they're putting in. That's called profit, baby. If you ever look around at work and you're like, damn, why does this suck? Or if you work on some product and you're like, man, why don't we ever fix this? Because somebody at some place in the management pipeline has looked at that and said, the amount of money that we would make by fixing this thing is not going to make up for the amount of money that that we would have to pay to fix it. So let it be broke, okay? That's basically how all those decisions are made.
Profoundly affects every dimension of who you are. Affects your heart, affects your lungs, affects your cortisol level, affects your mind, affects the way that you cope with things, affects the way that you survive. Because you have to survive this. I don't think anyone can help you unless we understand the ways in which you're broken. You get me, man? We can't, there's no way. People sort of labeling you and sort of saying, oh, like loxapine is going to fix this and trazodone is going to fix this. That doesn't even begin to touch the surface. I think if you want any chance, you have to have someone understand you.
Well, I'm glad that they got a variety of people for this. For however maybe you want to say this is, it's nice. It's not just all a bunch of like kids. Not to say that kids' problems aren't real. They are. But it's nice that they got a variety of people here. I do think it's important sometimes to have a therapist or to have a therapist that is a little bit more like you, I guess, similar. Like I think women having women therapists or men having men therapists or people that are a little bit closer in age or have had similar life experiences, I think it really does help. I think it establishes a ton of credibility when somebody's been through a thing that you've already been through.
Right, and it doesn't even begin to touch the surface. I think if you want any chance, you have to have someone understand you, right, and what you struggle with on a day-to-day basis.
I think that you can have people that have empathy. But to understand on that surface level, I don't think I've came across that.
I believe you, man.
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, even though you believe me and all this, what does it do for me? What does it do for me? You know what I mean? Like, what does that do for me? After we finish all this, guess what? I'm going to go back to that house. I'm going to sit down. And I'm going to contemplate my life. You feel me? I'm going to contemplate it. I contemplate it every day. And it's been going on for so long that now at this point, like
you,
I said,
you've been alone with this, right?
Yeah, most definitely. I don't try to be a burden on nobody. I don't think anybody wants to be a burden on anybody. It's what it is. You know what I mean?
So, Lamar, I know this is going to sound empty. Here's my experience. I've done a lot of work with veterans. First thing that I learned is y'all don't come back the same. Each and every one of you comes back a little bit different. Second thing is I don't know that there's anything that I can do or anyone else can do that will actually help you. I don't know that, man. Whatever happened over there was so bad. And there's a new diagnosis, by the way, called moral injury, which is a form of PTSD that is not when something happens to you. Moral injury is when a good person is made to do bad things or when a good person watches someone else do bad things. That breaks us in a different kind of way. I will say, though, that what I'm hearing is that people haven't really understood you and that you've been doing this alone. And I don't know that this is, I can't predict the future. I don't know you. Maybe I'm an arrogant guy who says this. But I would say that since you like analogies, if I take my car to the shop and no one understands what's wrong with it and people start fixing it, that's what people have been doing with you.
Yeah.
They've been saying, hey, man, this is going to work. Hey, man, this is going to work. Hey, man, this is going to work. Now, as I say this to you, what are you feeling, Lamar? I see you shaking.
I'm shaking because, like I said, after hearing the same thing, it feels repetitive. It feels like I'm in a loop. Like, it just feels like a loop.
What's it like to be stuck in this loop?
Every day I feel like it might be my last. Like, you know what I mean? Might be my last.
Lamar, I'm grateful to you.
Grateful, yeah.
Wait, Jesus, what? Hold on.
It just feels like a loop.
What's it like to be stuck in this loop?
Every day I feel like it might be my last. Like, you know what I mean? Might be my last.
Lamar, I'm...
This is a hard thing. You can say this, and it's meaningless, unfortunately. But like, I genuinely feel like if there was some kind of organization or something where I feel like I genuinely feel with no research, if you take people whose lives are just f***ed, so much of your life can be dictated by your surrounding environment. If you could just rip these people out and throw them, it can be a jungle somewhere, and like, hey, for 3 months we're just gonna live outside and do some shit. Or it could even just be like you're gonna go live in a shack in some other place, and you're just gonna do fast food worker, whatever's like a complete change from your ordinary life. I feel like it would do a lot of good for people. If you're stuck in a certain environment and you have like a certain set of behaviors, like your environment adapts to your behaviors, and your behaviors adapt to your environment, right? You're likely to buy the same things, place the same things around your house in a way that reinforce behaviors. Your behaviors will become reflected of those things. And then whenever you're trying to like change a behavior, like, I'm not going to do this thing anymore. And it's like every single thing in your life that you've established up to this point this far is going to fight against you and trying to change that behavior. And it's just so hard to do that on your own, I think. I think it's so hard to do that.
I'm grateful to you.
Which is another thing. On the flip side of that is why growing up in a rich family, growing up in a well-adjusted family sets you up for success so much in early life. Because so many kids that might hate taking piano lessons or hate doing extracurriculars or hate that their parents are hounding them for whatever, that when they're on you for that for your whole life, by the time you're, you know, 14, 15, like you've been set up for so much success, you don't even realize how helpful it is, you know?
Might be my last.
Have you ever had to do that? Sometimes. What I'll try to do if I want to do some shit like that, I have something coming up soon, actually, because I'm going to move all my shit in here, is if I try to make a big rearrangement of stuff in my home, I'll try to associate that with like a big behavior change. I think I did that when I wanted to change my sleep, because I used to be, if you watched my stream a long time ago, bro, I would wake up at like 7 p.m. and then I would stream until like 8 or 9 a.m. My sleep was for probably a decade. I also work night shift at the casino too. I just kind of assume that my sleep would just always be like that. Like basically it's kind of a non-24, like reverse circadian rhythm. If I try to like change stuff up around my house a lot, I'll also try to like pair a behavior change with that so I can start to associate it. But if you move, it could be a good way to do it. Sometimes like New Year's resolutions can help. Maybe it's a new year, but it's very hard if your environment is the exact same thing, especially if there's other people that are reinforcing bad behaviors, to make a big behavior change. I think that's really, really, really difficult to do.
Might be my last, like, you know what I mean? Might be my last.
Lamar, I'm grateful to you.
Grateful,
yep. Your ADHD meds help your sleep behavior? For me, they did, yes, a little bit. But I mean, my sleep, they did help quite a bit for some issues I was having, but my sleep was majorly 10, 15 years ago. Like, again, if you watch my stream way back in the day, I would wake up at 5 or 6 p.m. and I would stream until like 8 or 9, and I'd sleep around like 10 a.m. That was like a normal day for me. It was super.
And I know it sounds kind of weird. I can see that you're really struggling. I can see that every day, on the one hand, it feels inevitable. And on the other hand, it feels like one day you're going to be off the loop and you're never going to come back, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Feels that way. And I think the beautiful thing about this, and I know it sounds weird to call it beautiful, is it blows my mind how many people feel the way that you do. There are a lot of people out there that have come back.
Like, if this guy is just going, I understand what this guy's saying, right? Like, this is great. You're telling me all this and it feels good right now. But like, I'm about to go home, you know, do the same shit, run the same loop, and then like what changes, you know?
From war, have been cops, have been firefighters, and when they look at you, when they see you, I think what they see is someone who is like them, that they're not alone in this world.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we can fix you, man, but I certainly know that if you're alone, it's going to be way harder.
It's just my anxiety rises sometimes.
It's okay.
All right, we're going to pause here. Lamar, thank you.
Yeah.
Snap some to Lamar.
My next surrounded claim is you can be productive and successful while still being deeply depressed.
All right, Ian, your flag was up. You ready to go to the center?
Sorry.
How are you doing?
What's your name, bro?
Ian.
Ian? Oh, look, nice to meet you, man.
All right, so I think my first problem is I see a bunch of women with red flags and I'm immediately attracted to them.
Okay.
The red flags.
Oh, gotcha.
I want to say, like, everyone in this circle is a fucking hero. There are days where just...
Why would you say... Oh, wait, I thought that he was like... I thought he was just saying, like, in general. Why would you say, okay, don't, guys, stop. Jesus. Okay. Whatever. Never forget it.
Getting to live to the end of the day without doing something to yourself is the hardest thing to do, and we all did it. I would like to stay in touch with everybody because I think we can help each other better than your...
It was? He's making a secondary joke? Or was it just a joke? I don't know. Never mind. Sorry. I'm biased against I hate man. My bad. Okay.
Your training, because we have lived it and we know what it's like. I would say, like, on the surface, people would consider me a successful person. I'm a musician as well. The difference is I don't like music. I'm just good at it. I used to love it. I don't want to do it anymore. I wanted to be a therapist like you because I want to help people. And I think, like, just from the experience is the real education. Being depressed is the education. I'm divorced.
Okay.
I woke up one day and noticed my ex-wife's phone was on Snapchat and found out she was cheating on me.
Okay.
I laid on the floor for 3 days and did not eat. I wanted to die. I've kind of wanted to die ever since that. 0 stars, would not recommend.
Okay.
I appreciate anyone that's trying to help us. But I think we could help each other better than maybe a professional can.
Okay. So it seems like that's what you want to talk about, that y'all can help each other better than a professional can. Sure. I mean, I think there's plenty of evidence that there are different kinds of help. So a really good example of this is, so I do a lot of addiction psychiatry. So
he's attracted to red flag girls. That's the joke. No, I understand. I understand. It's fine. Don't worry about it. Never mind.
There are certain ways that I can help people. But what we know from tons of studies is that peer support is huge for helping people. I remember my favorite moment of medical school was attending an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And it was so incredibly powerful. It is a kind of help that human beings can get from each other called peer support, which is very...
Wants to be a therapist because he has issues and wants saving himself, LeMayo, level one psychology. I mean, I think that a lot of people, I've said this before, I think that one of the most fundamental aspects of human existence is the desire to be understood by other humans. I think that's a very important fundamental thing. I mean, if I think something's wrong with you, if you have issues, I think that feeling is even higher because even fewer people understand you and you're not getting that mutual understanding. So, I mean, that response isn't that surprising to me.
It is a kind of help that human beings can get from each other called peer support, which is very different from psychiatry. And I think most of the studies show that both help in different ways. But if you were to say that you can help everyone here around you in a way that maybe I can't, which is an interesting conjecture because you're assuming that I haven't struggled with depression.
Ooh.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you. I think that that's...
I don't think I said you.
Yeah.
Because I did say that I wanted to be a therapist too because, and maybe that's why you ended up here. But I think it's more like the experience is the teacher.
Sure.
Right.
Do you want to talk about you a little bit or not so
sure.
much? Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit? So you said, on the outside, people would see you as successful. What's on the inside?
Much like the last musician, a lot of self-criticism, a lot of discouragement, and just in general, not thinking I've done enough, thinking I've let everybody that believed in me down.
So I'm curious, when you were growing up, did you find that whether you were happy or not depends on the people around you?
It depends a lot on the women in my life, if I'm happy or not.
Yes. Can you say more about that?
Yeah. I mean, I know that I need external validation, especially from women, to be happy.
Okay.
Right. So perhaps growing up, my parents were very supportive, maybe.
Were they supportive or did you find that they were very conditional with their love or support?
I don't know if I would know the difference.
Okay. So I think that's telling. So here's something that I've seen, and there's also research about this, which is that, a lot of times people who are very successful and very unhappy on the inside, a couple of things. One is when you beat yourself up, you work harder than everybody else.
Right? I do.
Yeah.
For sure.
So that's number one. Second thing is that oftentimes people who are like this believe that there's a choice between happiness and success. It's interesting. There's a term called psychic amputation where you lop off a part of yourself in order to become successful. You have to sacrifice.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
This guy's good. He's pretty good.
Right?
Yeah.
So I just saw your eyes light up. There are things that you want to do, but what do you say to yourself when you want to do something?
When I was trying to be good at guitar, when I was coming up, I sacrificed so much socialization just to sit in my room and twiddle my fingers on the instrument. Cause I was like, I'm not where I need to be. It's not time to party yet. I was in a punk rock band. I didn't do any drugs. What the hell?
You deny yourself a lot of enjoyment.
Yeah.
Right? You make sacrifices to become successful.
Right.
Now, let me ask you this, okay? When you deny yourself a lot of enjoyment, does it kind of make sense that your happiness with yourself would go down?
Yeah.
Because a lot of what makes us happy is when I'm like, I want a cupcake, and then I eat a cupcake, then I feel good on the inside.
I don't eat any cupcakes, you see? My revenge body here?
I see it, right? So when you don't get that happiness from yourself, where do you think it has to come from?
It has to come from outside sources. Therapy.
Right. So, and in your case, which outside sources?
From women.
There we go. Right.
Yeah.
And so now you're kind of stuck because now.
Yeah, the shame of being different and unable to stop a drug or behavior when it's ruining your life and those lives around you, it becomes essential to find others who have the thoughts you believe are unique to you in order to believe there's a solution for you if it's working for them. Yeah, there's that, and there's also that usually when you have one of these negative things like an addiction issue or something else, generally the most visible examples in life are going to be terrible, and that just kind of like reinforces the dog feelings. I really like in The Pit that Langdon has had an addiction issue because he's a very talented doctor. He's very successful. He does it well, but like he has an addiction issue because generally speaking, I feel like the vast majority of people shown in media with addiction issues are just losers. There's not very many high functioning people. It was a big criticism I had of House and a big criticism I had of the Queen's Gambit or whatever. Sometimes I feel like some of these shows glorify drug use way too much. And I don't know how I feel about it sometimes. I feel like House glorified the Vicodin use quite a bit. And so, yeah, same thing with that Queen's Gambit. It didn't really seem like she suffered any negative issues related to drug stuff. Like, she just kind of, like, quit and it was fine. And she had, like, all the superpowers afterwards. Like, I don't know. Whatever. There are more high-functioning addicts than you'd think, Destiny. Sure. There could be a lot of high-functioning addicts, but generally it's only for a certain period of time, and then eventually you will crash. I think, generally speaking, I think addiction definitionally is hard to kind of keep in control, you know? I had a mad opiate addiction, been sober for 16 years now, spent a lot of time working on how to rewire my brain. Good job. The drug dependency ruined House's personal life. So, I don't know if I want to do this argument right now. You can think that.
Now you've sort of created this system where if I were to tell you, eat a cupcake.
No.
Right? Do you want a cupcake?
Yeah. I would. Like, gotta worry about abs, though. Like this.
Right? So, and you need abs. Why?
So that women will like me.
Right? And then if women like you, then how do you feel?
Great.
So you've got to make a decision, Ian. I mean, this is only for
friends of mine are going to go, basically. No. Okay, this is the same reason I feel like Breaking Bad, I think, failed morally as a show. I think that if you, in order to show that a character has lost something or there's a bad effect, it has to affect the thing that the person cares about. For House, the idea that drugs ruined his life is a very hard sell when the thing that he cares about the most, seemingly throughout the entire show, is his intellect. And like, he kind of wants a life with other people, but that always seems to be secondary to the intellect thing. And kind of like losing the life of other people and like having the friendship with Wilson at the end, I guess, is like kind of nice. But like, to somebody like House, okay, or to somebody that identifies with the character of House, a thing that would have been a trillion times more horrible or debilitating was to show the addiction to the Vicodin having a negative impact on his intellect or his diagnostic abilities. That would have been a much more horrendous wake-up call rather than like, well, I can either choose to abuse this drug and be the most intelligent motherfucker on the planet and be so goddamn intelligent, and that's the thing I care about the most, or I could give up the drugs and just not be as good as I am and I guess have some friends. That's like, you're in that place, you're kind of like choosing between two valid paths. I don't know. Maybe you want to be like the smartest motherfucker on the planet and give up, you know, normal friendships and all that shit to do that. Or you could just be like kind of dumber and do like that. I feel like that's not like the best. I don't know.
For you to do is, do you want to continue living life the way that you have? Or do you want to allow yourself to be happy with things that you want, giving yourself those things?
So I've been instilled with this mentality that if I work hard, like we're all told this as a kid, you're going to get what you want.
How's it working out?
Not well.
So you want to change it?
Has Destiny not watched a full season of House? The show absolutely does not glorify Vicodin use. I understand why you would say that. Listen, we're going to ban Media Talks from my chat because you guys are crazy. If you don't think House glorifies drug use, I just don't know what to say to you. You can say that. I don't know. Whatever. If you think that, that's fine. Then good for you.
So stop working hard and get what I want?
That's not what I asked. Like, do you want to change that?
Whoa! Hold
this time. Let me back up.
Or do you want to allow yourself to be happy with things that you want, giving yourself those things?
So I've been instilled with this mentality that if I work hard, like we're all told this as a kid, you're going to get what you want.
Can you explain the Breaking Bad failing morally thing? We already talked about this on stream. I think that Walt's character made all the right choices and fulfilled its destiny in exactly the way that it wanted it to and accomplished everything it wanted to. And I don't think that there was ever an alternative path that would have shown if he had made a more moral choice, a more morally acceptable choice or good choice, that his life would have turned out better. The morally good path for Walt was to lay in bed dying while what he felt like were previous business owners that f***ed him over, donated money to him, and everybody sat around and watched him die like a decrepit f***ing loser. But instead, the way that he died was as the kingpin best meth producer in the entire f***ing world, who managed to kill every single person that had wronged him and getting vengeance for the death of his brother while freeing his old partner and then dying in the middle of his glorious lab where he was reminded of his, like, accomplishing his the ultimate dream of masculinity, his Heisenberg dream fantasy that he always wanted. There's a very shallow analysis of, like, well, he died and he didn't get to be with his family, but his family sucked and they didn't like him and he didn't like them. And that wasn't, like, the fulfilling thing for him. He wanted to be a man who went out and built a drug empire and do something that was worthy of his masculinity. And there was absolutely nothing in the good version of his life that would have allowed for him to feel like he'd fulfill that masculine desire in the same way. And dying there like a loser in bed of cancer while other people give you money, that doesn't fulfill that masculine aspect in any kind of way, healthy or unhealthy. But listen, yeah, if you want to disagree, that's fine. Okay.
Yourself to be happy with things that you want. Giving yourself those things.
So I've been instilled with this mentality that if I work hard, like we're all told this as a kid, you're going to get what you want.
How's it working out?
Not well.
So you want to change it?
So stop working hard and get what I want?
That's not what I asked. Do you want to change that?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Okay. Of course. It's just a hard society. You know, I got divorced and found out I was 5'7", and nobody likes that. So
yep.
It's a hard one for you to fix.
And Dr. Kidd, could we also, I think there's like a specific thing that you're alluding to here. The need for validation from women.
Excuse me. They were in a conversation, motherfucker.
You know, I think there's going to be a lot of guys who might be watching this video who feel that specific need. Could you hit that more specifically?
I think, so we live in a society where validation from women.
What about the Amber hallucination arc? Was that not directly addressing House's ability to diagnose relative to his drug abuse? Didn't he literally abuse even more drugs to diagnose Amber? Like, when they show drug abuse in shows, it's always, like, kind of sexy and cool. And I'm, like, using more drugs to explore my mind and, like, all this, like, awesome, cool but, like, people that abuse drugs, like, end up, their lives are messy. They steal from people. Everybody around them in their life starts to not trust them. Like, when you're past the high-functioning part and you start to slide into, like, disorder and disarray and disaster, like, nothing about that experience is sexy or cool or awesome. It just gets, like, really, really horrible in so many different ways. And House, I feel like he's always got enough people around him that he probably doesn't deserve that keep him from sliding into that. And he always maintains the sharpness of his mind and his intellectual ability to be on top of everything in the world. Yeah.
Women, and this is what's really interesting, is amongst dudes is the way that we get respect. It's not even about the women. It's actually amongst dudes. So, you know, if you're someone who really struggles with being very, very susceptible to needing validation, I think a lot of this is because you've been programmed to let parts of yourself go. As long as you are not happy with yourself, you will be dependent.
Stop. Why do you call that a failing of Breaking Bad? It sounds like a well-written depiction of life to me. What society wants from us kind of sucks compared to successful immorality. Well, because that, in my opinion, if you're performing art, you shouldn't be trying to convey negative moral messages to people. It should be a positive moral message, right? The idea shouldn't be that, like, well, if you really want to be masculine and manly like Walt, then you need to abandon everything in ordinary life, you know, your family, well, not really, literally, but, like, you know, just leave your family, leave your job, leave ordinary society, become a criminal, become a kingpin, kill your brother-in-law, do these horrible things, and that's, like, the ultimate fulfillment of masculinity. I feel like to convey a better moral message, I feel like Breaking Bad needed to have, there needed to be some way for Walt to fulfill his masculinity in his ordinary life. And I just don't feel like that was ever presented as an option in Breaking Bad. That just didn't seem to be possible to me. So I think that I feel like that's like a bit of a moral failing of the show. Like, I think you can come away from Breaking Bad identifying. I think this was part of the problem too, actually, because I thought about this a lot. I hate talking about me on stream. I thought about this a lot too, because I always wondered, and I was one of the people who hated Skylar. And then as you kind of like grow up a little bit, you're like, oh, you know, actually Skylar's in a pretty shit position. It kind of sucks for her the whole time. But then when I go back and I think about it, I feel like the reason why you hate Skylar, one of the reasons why, is because Walter is a character that you can identify with. And I think you empathize, especially as a man, for his fulfillment of like ego and masculinity. And there really is absolutely no alternative path for him to feel like he's achieved his masculinity. There's nothing given in that show aside from him doing the crazy drug empire. Like, it seemed like he'd already closed all the doors in his life that could have gotten him to that point by the time he's dying of cancer in the show. So I don't know. I feel like that's a, I think that's bad.
It's not even about the women. It's actually amongst dudes. So, you know, if you're someone who really struggles with being very, very susceptible to needing validation, I think a lot of this is because
not really. He's given an out by his previous partners, and he says no because he's a Spurg. I don't know how to convey this to you. You're not... The out that he was given was that he could just shut the fuck up and die of cancer while other people pay his bills. You understand that's not fulfilling... That's not fulfilling his masculine desire to make a name for himself in the world or to be recognized for his intelligence or his accomplishments, right? That's not the same thing. Like, you guys are... You're using... I don't know what the name for this is. You motherfuckers do this shit all the time. You're using like external things in the world that you value. Like, oh, well, everybody values their family. And then you're projecting that like onto the media. But like, he had his family. He could have valued his family. But clearly that wasn't enough for him. There was some like urge to create something that his ego would feel fulfilled by. And nothing in his life was doing that. And sitting there and dying of cancer while other people pay for it, it wouldn't have fulfilled the character. What stopped him from taking the money for his treatment and doing something legal to fulfill his urges? What? I don't know. If there was another pathway in the show that had been explored more, I think you could have made that argument. But I feel like that just wasn't explored more. Like, if he had the opportunity to, I don't know, if I don't even know how he would present it. He was working at some other business, or there was some like reasonable path forward or whatever, and he decides to forego it because the drug path is easier, then I think the show would have succeeded more on those grounds. But I feel like Walt is a character that you could easily identify with and feel fully justified for every decision he made along the way until the very end of the show. And you're like, oh, yeah, I get it, you know? Yeah, good for him, you know? I think that's not... I don't think that's good. In my opinion. But... Walt's idea of masculinity was toxic. That's the point? No... I think wanting to be recognized, wanting to feel like you've accomplished something noteworthy, wanting to, I don't think that that's necessarily toxic. It can come out in toxic ways, like being a drug dealer and having people die and murdering people. That's bad for sure. But like the fundamental drive of Walt to want to be a man and to be recognized for like things that you think are, you know, extreme talents you have related to your intelligence or anything else. Like, I don't think that's toxic. And there's no normal path for him in life by the time Breaking Bad starts that would allow him to fulfill any of that. He would just die in bed and whatever. Okay.
Need for validation from women. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of guys who might be watching this video who feel that specific need. Could you hit that more specifically?
I think, so we live in a society where validation from women, and this is what's really interesting, is amongst dudes is the way that we get respect. It's not even about the women. It's actually amongst dudes. So, you know, if you're someone who really struggles with being very, very susceptible to needing validation, I think a lot of this is because you've been programmed to let parts of yourself go. As long as you are not happy with yourself, you will be dependent on the people around you to get that sense of happiness. And just to give you just a tiny little example. So I struggled to date. I was just terrible at it for many years. And then I decided to become a monk and I decided to be celibate. And then I was like, I'm done with women. I'm done. I'm going to just be celibate for the rest of my life. And it turns out that once I found peace with that, That's when I met my wife. It's really bizarre.
I'm not going to do that, but thank you.
We got to pause here. Thank you, Ian. Thanks, Dr.
Thank you so much.
Right,
yeah.
All right, Megan, I saw your flag up. Do you want to go to the center?
Hey, Megan. I'll look. Nice to meet you.
I think for me, my depression kind of stems from this sort of perfectionist mindset that I have for myself. And I feel like I can't get to a sense of success or...
Did House fail to provide a moral benefit to House? What happens if he stopped the Vicodin? Well, it seemed like the choice was always like, you can either be the best doctor in the world or you can have like friends and family. And again, I feel like that feels to me like glorifying drug use, but I don't know.
And I feel like I can't get to a sense of success or self-acceptance because I feel like nothing I do is ever good enough for myself. And every time I reach those goals, I set higher ones for myself. And it's just kind of a never-ending, like, I'll never be good enough, so why try kind of mentality.
And do you find that being perfectionistic helps you?
It kind of keeps me going in a sense that, like, I feel like, you know, kind of what Ian said, I feel like if I just work hard and keep going, that'll kind of get what I want. But it almost feels like that gets farther and farther away the harder that I try.
Yeah, but it does keep you moving,
right?
It
does, yeah.
And so if you didn't have that to keep you moving, what would happen?
Yeah, we just kind of stop trying, I think.
You'd stop trying.
Yeah.
And so what are you trying for? What are you trying to achieve?
I think just... happiness, self-acceptance, success.
And what would you have to be in order to be comfortable to accept yourself, right? You want to accept a certain version of yourself, right?
Right. The version I have in my head that I feel like is just like the perfect, like I don't make any mistakes. I'm good at everything. I have everything that I need or desire, and I don't have any flaws, I suppose.
How did that become the standard? Why did you need to be so good?
Comparing myself to others is a big one.
Okay.
So I'll see others and what they're doing and think that I need to match that or be better than that.
Okay. And if you aren't perfect, how do you feel about yourself?
I don't like myself.
Do you remember a time that you did like yourself?
When I was a kid, just as I got older into high school and everything, I just kind of stopped feeling good about myself.
So I think it's a really, really, really common problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes we forget that human beings didn't evolve to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
We evolved to function. And so you may wonder, like, you know, why is depression a part of how we experience things? And I think sometimes people who are very perfectionistic, you know, there are a couple things. The first is that it helps you actually, it's a huge motivational component, right? Because if I want to be better, then I motivate myself and I keep pushing myself. I beat myself up until I achieve this thing. And then once I achieve that thing, then I will be happy. So I think the first thing is that this doesn't get better. Because if I were to tell you, okay, Megan, you should learn to love and accept yourself. Would you actually do that?
It's easier said than done.
Easier said than done. What would stop you from doing it?
The like negative thoughts in my head of just not feeling good enough.
Not feeling good enough, right?
Right.
And so I think there's an element there that you can look for, which is that if you were to accept yourself, what would happen in your life? Let me ask you that. What would your life look like if you had self-acceptance?
I think I'd be happier. I'd be less hard on myself.
Would you do stuff?
Yeah, I would.
Okay. So that's actually really good. So sometimes people get stuck in this perfectionism and they get dependent on it for motivation. It doesn't sound like that's the case with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to share another concept, which is, you know, I think comparison is a huge part of perfectionism.
Mm-hmm.
One really interesting thing about perfectionism is that it's not like a diagnosis, but it is actually a way that our brain thinks, predisposes you to things like depression and anxiety. And so the other thing that I would strongly encourage you to do is to focus less on comparisons, mm-hmm. but notice how much your mind compares.
Mm-hmm.
This is where this gets a little bit more Eastern, but basically we have this sense of ego or identity. And I like, this is who I am and I want to be this thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's like an idea in your head. It's not really who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And another really common thing that happens when we're perfectionistic is we compare our insides to other people's outsides.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you this. This is going to be really kind of focused. When you do a good job, what are the reasons that your mind comes up with? Like, why did you do a good job? What does it say?
Like, if I worked hard at something, it'll say, like, you worked hard at that, you deserve that.
Really? It'll say that?
Sometimes.
What else does it say?
Does
it say you got lucky?
Sometimes.
When somebody else does a good job, what does your mind say about why they did a good job?
That they're just good at it, or they...
Talented?
They're talented, they're
easy
lucky, they just got it.
They just got it.
Yeah.
And when you do a good job, are you talented or lucky?
I don't often consider myself that, no.
Yeah, so this is really important. Where it's so interesting because there's research that shows that when people attribute other people's successes to talent or hard work, mm-hmm. but their own successes to things like luck or circumstances or stuff like that, literally you're judging yourself on a different standard from the way that you're judging other people.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you do that, then this will continue. Mm. And what some people find is helpful is when somebody else does a good job, to ask yourself, how did that other person get lucky? Mm. And when you did a good job, what did you do to deserve it? And it sounds like you're actually sort of halfway there because you do that sometimes.
Yeah, I do catch myself, you know, thinking those things, but then it just goes right back to like the thoughts of like, well, if you were good enough, you would be able to be as successful as them, but you're not, so.
Yeah, so I would really tunnel down into how.
I feel like the comparison thing he's talking about is really, really exacerbated by internet consumption. Yeah, probably. I think that, it's probably not good for a lot of us, yeah.
How you learned that you're fundamentally not good, right? Because a lot of that is like you are striving, so you're down here and you want to be perfect because you're up here. The question is, where did you get the idea that you're down here to begin with?
Yeah, that makes sense.
We're going to pause here. Thanks, Megan.
Thank you, Megan.
Thank you.
Kashish, you ready to go?
Hello.
Hi, I'm Kashish.
Kashish? Oh, look, nice to meet you.
So I'm someone who also feels like no matter how much I accomplish, the bar is always raising. As if like if I get into the law school I want, the next thing is like, I have to pass the bar, get a job, and it just keeps going and snowballing. So it's hard for me to feel satisfied with my success. And I think I've correlated my happiness with it from like the beginning.
How long is this video? 44 minutes.
But I'm also very self-aware of it. So I'm not sure what
should
be done.
You seem super self-aware.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what should be done for people like me who know the problem but are just unsure of how to go about it.
Yeah, so is your happiness correlated with your success?
It has been from when I was a kid, and I still struggle with that sometimes.
What were you taught as a kid?
The better you are, the more people like you, in the sense of like I was always in the honors programs, getting first place in sports and everything, and it just kept getting reinforced because I think society rewards productivity and success more than just mental well-being or soft skills.
Yeah, what would your parents say about mental well-being versus getting an A?
I mean, they would ideally want me to score well, but my parents have never had as high expectations of me as I do of myself. So usually it's me where I would be like upset in second grade because I got a 9.5 out of 10. And they'd be like, oh, that's a great score. You're doing amazing. I just like couldn't believe that because it wasn't perfect.
Do you want that to change?
Yes.
Are you sure?
That's a good one.
I just like couldn't believe that.
Sometimes when you have issues like this, when you say that you want a thing to change, you don't actually, but like you think you should say that, but you don't really want it to change. This is like a difficult, depending on where you're at.
Because it wasn't perfect.
Do you want that to change?
Yes.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Why?
Because it's honestly miserable always wanting to meet the next goal, and the goal is always going to keep raising. I don't think there's like a solution out of it. I see it as kind of like a circular problem where once I meet the goal, I just go to the next one and just keeps going and going and going. And it seems like the only way out of it is getting rid of that attachment from success and happiness.
So this is going to be a bit hard. So I'm going to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want this to change?
I'm not sure, actually.
There we go. Right. So I asked you, do you want it to change? And then you said,
well, I don't know why you changed your answer now. I feel like he's farming a bit, but maybe, I don't know.
Yes. And Now I asked it again and you're saying, I'm not sure. So walk us through. Where's the conflict?
The conflict is the reinforcement you get from being successful and like gaining all of it. It just makes me feel more loved and desired or seen as well. And since I've attached my worth to my happiness to my achievements, it just feels like that's the only way for me to be happy. But I'm also very well aware that that's not true.
Very good. Okay, so now we come to a really interesting problem, which is that you know intellectually this is not good.
Yes.
Right? But there is a part of you that still wants it.
Yes.
Right? You know, and as someone who had aspirations to go to Harvard myself, this is something that I struggled with a lot as well. But it comes down to the nature of happiness. So this is going to be a little bit...
Okay. Well, he also did his residency at Harvard. So, okay. You did do it. Chill.
Different. But what is happiness?
I feel like my answer would be like happiness is success, but not anymore. I'm trying to change that.
No. Don't change it.
Okay.
Yeah. So when you feel happy when you're successful?
Yes.
Okay. So right.
Undergrad? No, he did his residency there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So then, but what does success do in you that makes you happy?
It makes me feel as if I'm valuable, as if my skills are being put to good use, as if I'm useful maybe. Otherwise, if I'm just like in bed or not doing anything, I just feel like awful, like I should be doing something or like I should be maximizing my time.
Okay, when you say you should be maximizing your time, you feel tortured, right?
Yes.
So there's a lot going on in your head. Mm-hmm. And when you are maximizing your time, what's going on in your head?
The busier I am, the less I have to think about my feelings and my thoughts.
Oh, great. Okay, good. So the busier you are, the less you think.
Yes.
The more tortured you are, the more you think.
Yes.
Right? When we become content, I want everybody to think about this. I want something. Oh my God. I want this person to say yes when I ask them out on a date. I want to go to Harvard. Mm-hmm. I want to do this. I want to do this. Wanting a lot of mental activity.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting at the beach, looking at the sun can still be torture if I'm thinking about all the stuff that I should be
doing. Yes.
If you look at the nature of contentment, I want a cookie. There's activity in the mind. Once I get my cookie, there's nothing in the mind. There's a certain kind of thing that brings your mind to a calm state.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can duplicate that calm state without being dependent on success, then you will be happy.
Sorry, we got to pause and move on to the next participant. No, but thank you, Kashish.
Thank you.
All right, Mylene, your flag was up. You ready to go to the center?
Hey.
Dr. Karen, you're Dr. Karen.
Yeah, all of them. Mylene?
Mylene.
Nice to meet you, Mylene.
Nice to meet you. Yes, I do believe that you can be productive and successful. And the reason that I say that is because I've dealt with suicidal ideation for the majority of my life, for as long as I could remember. Last year, I had a pretty bad episode. I could not get up out of my bed. I refused to do anything for myself. I lost a ton of muscle. I lost the ability to be confident in myself. But the one thing that I was able to do was take my dog out for a walk. Even if I'm going through what I'm going through, I'm not going to abandon my dog. I'm not going to abandon my partner. And I think that's a success, you know. And I would like to bring this up because today, ironically, is my dad's birthday. And he did pass. And I wanted to share my story because I want to be productive. And by being here and talking about it, sharing and listening to people's stories, that's a goal that I have succeeded in by sitting here.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think it's sounds quite exhausting, actually, because I can see how hard you try.
Yeah.
I get the sense that you're always trying to move forward and that you're not letting the people or animals down around you, right? That there are lots of things that your depression may win on, but you're going to take your dog for a walk every single day because it deserves that.
Yeah.
I'm so curious. What's it like? I mean, you said you've been suicidal since
Every single answer she gives, how could you feel this way when there's a genocide happening?
Sounds like you were quite young.
Yeah. Growing up, I was never really encouraged to express my emotions. I grew up in a religious household where they believed that depression wasn't a thing. They tell me to pray. And, you know, I have nothing against religion, but I also wanted to feel seen. The lack of that took a toll on me, and I bottled it all in. And since it's never been addressed, it's so heavy on your heart. And you mentioned it earlier that, you know, it reflects on your body, and I feel it so much in like my chest and my heart, and it weighs heavy. And you have to put on this mask and just continue on as if you're okay.
Yeah, so listening to your story, Mylene, I'm struck by something, you know, I've seen, which is just so unfortunate as a psychiatrist, which is there's the burden of depression, and then there's the burden of not dealing with depression in the right way. So you actually carry two burdens, right? There's all of the negativity that maybe was there at baseline, and then there is the rejection from your family. There's the forcing yourself to put on a mask. There's pushing all those emotions down. Half of what I really struggle with as a psychiatrist is helping people unlearn the things that helped them survive.
Like unlearning the habits or unlearning the experiences?
Both, but I was talking about more about the habits. So when you grow up with depression, you have to adapt to survive.
Right.
And then those adaptations sometimes become maladaptive later on.
Yeah.
But then the problem is you can't just take those away.
Right.
Right? Because if you take that away, you're left with nothing or too much emotion or you're in bed all day or all these kinds of things.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so like tricky that you have to like unlearn something while learning something else. And it's really hard.
Yeah. And that's why I focus on alignment. You have to align your habits with your goals. Even if I'm unhappy at that moment, if I change that habit, it'll change the outcome and the result of how I feel about what comes out of it all.
Does that work?
It's worked so far.
We have to pause here.
Congrats. Pretty mentally healthy, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mylene. Thank you.
Don't get me wrong, he's great at identifying problems, but solutions, he seems to just ask a question. Well, I mean, one of the issues is he's only getting to talk to people for like 3 or 4 minutes. We're like speed diagnosing and, well, not diagnosing because it's not actual therapy, but it's a, like the time span is very short here.
My final surrounded claim is that if therapy didn't work for you before, it doesn't mean that nothing will.
Alexandra, are you ready to go to the center?
Hi, Mr.
Hey,
Alex.
Thank you for coming.
Oh, did you hear what he just said, guys?
Alexandra, are you ready to go to the center?
Peace Co's about to quote tweet this video. Oh, so the center does exist. I'm just kidding.
Hi, Mr.
Hey,
Alex.
Thank you for coming. Nice to meet you, Alex.
So I'm curious to know what made you choose this particular claim to bring to this.
So I think that somewhere along the way, we started saying that there's a right way to deal with depression. Mm-hmm. We said, go to a psychiatrist, take a medication, go see a therapist. And there are a lot of people who are struggling. And we said, this is the answer. This will help. This will fix you. Mm-hmm. And my experience has been that that isn't always the case. Mm-hmm. And there's a ton of new research, the wildest of which, weirdest trial I've seen to date, is for a stool transplant, which is what it sounds like. We take stool from one human being, and then we transplant that stool into another human being. And it turns out that this has been shown to improve depression. because the bacteria in your gut produce tryptophan. And tryptophan is a serotonin precursor. And when we boost serotonin transmission in the brain, it sometimes helps people with depression. For far too long, I think we've assumed that depression is a mental illness, whereas I think there's a lot of physiology to it. And so I think there's still a lot of options out there.
That's a weird statement that he just made. I feel like we've talked about this in the past, and he's had a totally different stance on that. It's that separating out to say, well, I thought it was a mental thing, but it's actually physiological. Well, I mean, your brain is an organ in the body. That's I think that's an interesting, I don't, that's a weird statement to make, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's the, it's only so much that psychiatrists or psychologists can do when you're in therapy. They only have an hour to diagnose, quickly treat, or figure out something, a quick solution for them in and out, especially like in America for healthcare and stuff like that. But what kind of protocols do you think would help other people who are struggling that maybe aren't seen, or like, instead of just, oh, here's a medication, try this and see what happens? And what are the like traits that you would say, oh, this person would need something else?
So one thing that's really interesting is there's evidence of inflammation in the brain with depression. So
I think guys probably agree that was terrible wording. I didn't understand it until, I didn't understand that way until he said it, but he said it. Maybe. We'd probably agree, I guess.
As your inflammation,
it just meant that like there are other things in the body that can affect your mind. That's not just like thought patterns or something. Maybe
level goes down, there is a good chance that depression improves. There are studies that, one study from 2003 found that exercise was just as effective as therapy in treating depression. It certainly helps some. I think there's a new wave of evidence-based psychotherapies, what we call the third wave. These are basically like the Eastern things. So mindfulness, a big thing that I think people can learn how to do, this is a skill, is to be cognitively flexible. So oftentimes in depression, our mind thinks one way, and then we think to ourselves, that's the way that it thinks. Learning to think,
therapy.
Not necessarily CBT, but CBT is a portion of this, literally holding contrary views at the same time. So even though if I break up with someone, I may think to myself, I'll be alone for the rest of my life, and this was a terrible waste of my time. At the same time, it can also be true that one relationship gives you more experience to be successful at the other one. So holding contrary claims is another really big thing. Dietary changes, we know that certain kinds of gut bacteria will actually improve depression. I think there's a lot out there that can be really helpful.
I understand that, because a lot of the therapies that people go through are the talk therapy and the medication therapy. I've been on SSRIs for a very long time. I recently stopped taking them for the past maybe 5 years, and I found that it really didn't help. But the other forms of therapy I've tried, they help, but it's, I always get back into the loop of where, like, then I go through 2 weeks of, oh man, I don't enjoy this anymore. I don't enjoy, I get the anhedonia, or the lack of motivation to do the things that I used to like, or I'm not getting the same oomph from what I was doing. What are the treatments after that? What am I supposed to do?
Yeah, so I think, you know, what I'm hearing is, and this is unfortunate, sometimes...
Are there conservative psychologists today? There must be, right? It just seems like they all think this is fake. No, I'm sure there are. They're just, I mean, keep in mind, most psychologists that you see aren't going to be very visible, right? Most psychologists aren't like talking on TV or YouTube or whatever about what they do, so.
You can do everything right. And you can still feel like And there, somewhere along the way, we got this idea that if I do more right stuff, it'll fix it. It'll fix it. And I think the thing that scares me the most as a psychiatrist is that it doesn't always work. It hurts that people have to try so hard to just not drown. You know? And I wish I had an answer that there was some way to make everything better. I think that's the real struggle.
I saw the Parker Brzee shit. 10 minute. I don't know. It looks retarded. I don't care. I don't know what it is. Okay. They let him fight.
There's something really weird that I've seen happen, and I wish I knew how to make it happen, which is sort of accepting that, you know what, this is something I'm going to have to deal with for the rest of my life. That once you sort of accept that, there's sort of a burden that can be eased up on. And then once there's a little bit of that easing of the burden, things feel a little bit easier. The weight becomes easier to carry. And I don't think it fixes everything, but I've seen some people really do get way better. And then everything else starts to work a little bit more. But I think there is that fundamental like grappling with the unfairness of being born with the curse of depression.
Okay, we got to pause there. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Alex.
Thank you.
Taylor?
Hi, how you doing?
Hey, Taylor, how are you? Yeah, absolutely.
People coughing up in here.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
sorry.
I'm one of them, so.
Okay. I have reached a place, I'm not a big fan of psychiatry, no shade, and have been in therapy for a number of years. I've done group, I've done individual, I've done cognitive behavioral therapy. Okay. That was my favorite.
Okay.
Hence the, you know, and then I do a lot of grounding exercises. As far as my depression goes, it's changed over time. The one that I suffer from now, unfortunately, is PMDD.
Okay.
Which is the premenstrual depression.
Uh-huh.
And it is horrific in a sense that I'm very confident, I'm funny, I'm cute, my body is T, I get money, but every 2 weeks, my world is about to get rocked and there's nothing I can do about it. I just strap in, buckle up, and just wait for the freight train to come. And it is so unfortunate. As far as that goes, it's just like, where are you left with that, you know? And then I'm also in a place where I have been on the front lines politically, and I also benefit from certain privileges in my life. Like, we're not in a war-torn country, and that is kind of where I find joy, which is actually awful to say. Nonetheless, is like, I don't take those smaller things for granted, right? What happens when you can't do anything about it at all? It's just like, what does one do at that point? I heard you talk about Buddhism, and that was really exciting to me because that's what saved me.
Okay.
I was raised Catholic, which is rough. And then when I got sober, I was introduced to spirituality.
Okay.
Would you say that the spiritual realm and the spiritual practice and even a metaphysic practice can be a solution in this sense where there's nothing else working?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
Would you like to hear more?
Yes.
Okay. So let's start with some data.
Okay.
So what's, you know, something really interesting. You're talking about how, you know, there's a lot of terrible stuff going on in the world today. One of the things that I found really confusing is why all survivors of genocidal conflicts don't have PTSD.
Wow.
You know, it's kind of...
Oh, man, this is a... Whoo, he's going into some real... Careful.
Weird, right? When we think about it, there's, like, terrible stuff happening. And like, the bad stuff is happening to everybody. Like, that's the whole point of a genocidal conflict. But actually, the majority of people don't end up psychologically traumatized in a way that impairs their function or debilitates them. One of the key things that we discovered when we tried to figure out why everyone who survived a genocidal conflict doesn't have PTSD is something called meaning-making. So it turns out that our human brain has something called adaptive misbelief. So human brains are designed to believe in all kinds of things that may not be true.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because it's like the height of psychological copium. We have to make sense of the world around us. And this is what's really interesting. I've worked with a lot of people with chronic pain, and I think this is a really hard situation because we can't really figure out what's wrong with you physically. There isn't a diagnosable thing that's going on. It's probably something in the brain, but there's nothing we can intervene on. So if, like, if you've got a stomach ache, but there's, like, nothing wrong with your stomach, then you just have to deal with the ache. So I think this is where making meaning, making sense of your suffering, is a huge part to finding relief.
Right.
And if you look at some of these Eastern spiritual perspectives, you know, they'll say that you can't control pain in life, but you do have some degree of control over whether you suffer or not.
Yes.
And this is where there are certain evidence-based, you know, techniques. I practice a lot of stuff that is not evidence-based because I spent years studying in India.
Mm.
But I think that, unfortunately, as a doctor, I mean, you're talking about PMDD and how there's nothing you can do about it.
Mm.
Yeah, you may not be able to fix that. But the way that you handle it, you can handle it in ways that seem to be better, in the sense that you can achieve some degree of peace, or you can handle it in ways that can enhance your suffering. There seems to be a lot of data to support that as well. I happen to think that that's true.
And we got to pause there because we're out of time. Thank you, Taylor.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank
Appreciate
you so much.
It.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Thanks, Blair.
Yeah. Daniela, you ready to go in the center?
Hey. Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you, Daniela.
My depression was, it started in 2024 when I was diagnosed with stage 4 Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Why are we so worried about what Dr. K was about to say? Or just bringing up the genocide topic, which is super spooky right now. He is right, though.
Okay.
Which is blood cancer. And honestly, I can say that in those situations, there's really nothing that could have helped me other than being healthy.
Yeah, I mean, what... thank you for sharing that. I'm curious, what are you thinking? How am I going to respond to that? Do you have an idea?
I feel like there's nothing you can possibly do in that situation because you can't solve the root of the problem, which is the cancer.
Yeah, so if we can't, and I agree with you, there's tons of research that shows that people who are diagnosed with cancer experience depression. Interesting thing is that's not just a psychological thing, it's also a physiologic thing, because in stage 4 cancer, your immune system is going whack, there's inflammation in the brain, and I think that this is, like, you know, you're right, that if you are diagnosed with something that could be a terminal illness, that the most natural reaction is to be depressed. I think that we also have, you know, a subspecialty of psychiatry of trying to help patients with cancer. Mm. You know, sometimes we help people cope with the prospect of death. We help them grieve the life that they could have lived, which they no longer get to because of cancer. And I'd like to think that we're able to alleviate their suffering in some way, but I would not, I mean, when you're someone who's been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer at quite a young age, I can't imagine that anything is going to fix that except for exactly what you said.
So what do you say in those situations?
I mean, okay. High survivor rate. Okay. Let's not be too dramatic here. Okay.
And psychiatry is kind of pointless?
Well, so that I would say no.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are plenty of patients I've worked with who would agree. I think it depends on define pointless.
So my thing with psychiatry is they kind of just help the person cope, but they don't solve the root of the problem. Even not just in like cancer, but in other situations.
Yeah, so I think when psychiatry, in some cases where it's practiced poorly, that's what we do. Mm-hmm. So I think psychiatry is a field, I think we made kind of a, I don't know if this is a mistake, it feels like a mistake to me, that we stopped accepting responsibility for patients' happiness. We started saying that we can teach you coping skills, that that's the best that we can do. We can't actually improve your life. We can just improve the way that you cope with your life. I don't think that we do that all the time, but I think it happens way too much. I think psychiatry as a field will throw in the towel very easily. And that too is not necessarily our fault, because I think there's a lot of stuff that we can't control, like we can't cure people's cancer necessarily. But I do think that psychiatry, when it's practiced in the best way, is not about coping. Coping is just what we do to help people put the fires out. Then you get to the real work. I think coping is not the last step, it's the first step.
I'm sorry, we have to pause there and switch participants, mm-hmm. But thank you.
Thank you.
Damn. He said cancer, boring.
Sterling, you ready to go? All right.
He said,
hello.
See.
Hello.
Just kidding. Sorry.
Hi, my name's Sterling. I use they, them pronouns.
Okay. Nice to meet you, Sterling.
Nice
thank
to
you
meet
for sharing
you.
Your pronouns.
Yeah, happily. So
are you going to use pronouns in a second person, first person conversation? Hey, how are you doing today? Blah, blah, blah. I guess if you would talk about a third person referencing them, I can understand why your family might think, wow, she's crazy. Or you say they're crazy, maybe. I guess, maybe. Whatever. I don't know. Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Whatever.
I think for me, I think therapy is like a good avenue, and psychiatry is a good door to open it up. But I feel like there's outside components that need to be done, at least in my personal experience, to like continue like growing positive mental health.
Can you share more about that?
Yeah, like I do think like mental health and physical health is tied. So like sometimes it is internal as well as like outernal, like your mental health versus your body trying to heal like old scars or old traumas, and just finding the balance between like what can really make you happy and bring you the peace and joy that you're like looking for long term.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. So I think that, you know, when you say psychiatry is a start, mm-hmm. I think there is a portion of things that we can do. And I think what we're discovering is that a lot of your mental functioning, my mental functioning, our brain exists within a body.
Yeah.
And the nature of the body can profoundly affect the mind. You know, I learned this when I went to India and I started studying yoga. I was in a really bad mental space.
Sure.
And there's a lot of evidence that shows that when we do some of these mind-body practices like yoga or Tai Chi, it rewires our nervous system, which will then affect our mind. So I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Having moments or classes where I was able to put myself into my body, realize, oh, I carry shame here. Mm-hmm. Like physically, I was like embarrassed to dance or to try something new. And it's working the muscles to like be open to like healing and like loving yourself, which is something like I know I've struggled, is just allowing myself to be okay or sit in my emotions.
Yeah. And what has been your experience of working with your body?
Something I found like that I really enjoy is like stage combat. So it's just something that it forces me to think how I react, how to keep my partner safe, and just being beyond myself.
So there are two kind of, I agree with you, but there are two things that I'd love to share.
Mm-hmm.
One is, so there are some interesting studies that show that when people are depressed, their physiology is constricted.
Yeah.
So their heart rate stays in a very narrow range. And when we're healthy, our heart rate will kind of go up or down because we get excited and then we get sad, we get tired, we get happy. And so there's literally evidence that shows that if you change your physiologic level of activity,
yeah,
that it'll improve your depression. And there's a really interesting version of this, which is sometimes when I would have patients who were having a panic attack, we tried one thing, which is we would step outside of my office and then we would run as fast as we can for 60 seconds, mm-hmm, in a park. And something really cool happens when you have a panic attack is, you know, your heart rate is elevating, but if you actually push your body even more, right, and you run really fast, then you feel exhausted at the end of that.
Yeah.
And when you feel physically exhausted, it actually slows down your heart rate, brings your respiratory rate under control, and in some cases can really help with the panic attack. And I completely agree that I think the body is the most underutilized tool in the treatment of depression today.
Yeah. All right, we're going to pause there. Thank you, Sterling.
Thank you.
We've got
time
for
nice
one,
yeah,
more. Lucia, you ready to go?
Lucia.
Nice to meet you, Alok.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you for coming today.
Thank you. I did want to like mention like earlier, she, what was your name again? Yeah, Alex, was talking about how like some people do like workouts or like anything to like take their mind off of it. And I feel like I'm the poster child for that, like working out and like reading and all these other hobbies, but it still doesn't feel like enough for me. And same with therapy. And it's different for me because like I did group therapy and then I also did like DBT group therapy. Like I still feel this like emptiness and this like shadow like following me, because also my depression is different, because I don't know if anybody else has like another mental health like that they deal with that kind of like coincides with their depression. Because for me, I just got diagnosed last year with BPD. So my depression is like a whole. I also have a problem with seeking validation, not necessarily from women, but like other people. And I like sort of kind of immerse myself in other people's to find like me in a way. And I don't know. Yeah.
Lucia, thank you so much for sharing that, because I'm glad that you shared the sense of emptiness that comes with BPD. So I think sometimes when we talk about depression, we talk about it like one thing, but depression is a way that you feel, and there are lots of different contributions to that. So I personally have learned so much from my patients with BPD. It's been some of the most rewarding and difficult clinical work I've ever had to do. So I'd like to just talk about BPD for a second, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know, there's a certain kind of depression where, see, we go through the world and I have a sense of who I am, mm-hmm. and I carry that with me wherever I go, right? So if someone calls me an idiot, I have some sense that I'm not an idiot. When someone has BPD, that can be absent or very, very quiet. Mm-hmm. And so the way that they feel is literally determined like a vacuum. It's a void that gets filled up by the way that people treat them. Yeah. So if someone treats you really well, you feel great. And if someone treats you really poorly, you internalize that.
Yeah.
And so a couple of things about BPD is that it's actually one of the things that improves really well. So I think like at 16 years out from diagnosis, 95%+ of people actually won't qualify for the diagnosis anymore. So it is something that can get healed. But I think that it's really, really hard before it happens. And I think that a lot of the work that I do around BPD is about really getting in touch with who you are. It feels empty. It feels like a void. And then the reason that people get diagnosed with this is because they're missing. Oftentimes there's trauma early in life. So
I wanted to touch on that, is that like I am like also religious. I'm Jewish. I converted after I graduated in 2024 from high school.
Can't pick a struggle. This girl's whew, she's stacking up disabilities.
And
God,
like once
damn.
Again, like I've done all of these things. And I think also what makes it hard for me with my BPD is also like the amount of trauma that I've been through, because
yeah.
I also went through a loss. Like I lost my father from COVID 6 years ago.
Okay.
And he was never in my life, like never knew him. And I also do seek my validation from relationships, because I've never had that father figure before.
Of course.
And it's like the abandonment and of everything. And
yeah.
That's why also like I sought conversion also to like help me move through it. But like yet again, like it still feels like there isn't that like light for me because of how much like other trauma that I've experienced too.
And I think that that's what's really hard. So the thing is, since there's that kind of void inside, I don't know if this makes sense.
Yeah.
The hopelessness can fill up that void, and then you will feel full of hopelessness, you know? And that's what I've seen with people with BPD, is that when you're feeling down, it fills up every cell of your body. Yeah. And then it's so big.
Mm-hmm.
The good news, there is a way to find that stability within yourself, to find a sense of self that kind of like is a life raft. And once it's kind of there, then people can really start to stabilize around it. And like I said, the outcomes from BPD are actually quite good. Just because it is one of the most painful things, that has nothing to do with how long it will last. That has nothing to do with its permanence.
Yeah.
All right, we have to pause. We're out of time. Thank you, Lucia.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, we've come to the last part of the show. Dr. Kate.
Did you watch the latest Sam Harris episode yet? They had a whole section on Hassan. Surprised me a bit. Didn't expect him to know who that was. I might watch it. Sam Harris is just brain broken on Islam, dude. I don't know what else to... It's like, because Israel-Palestine dominates so much of the conversation, I don't know if it's like even salvageable. I heard that people were saying that he says that like Mamdani is like a bigger threat in terms of ideology versus Hassan. I think it just comes down to like the Islam. Like that said, it's... Whew, Jesus.
Great job so far. We want you to look around the circle, and you can select somebody you haven't spoken to yet, or somebody who, you know, you want to keep exploring what they're going through. So you can choose anyone in the circle, but just take a moment, select them, and then let us know why.
Okay, so I have...
Listen to it. I mean, you can link it.
Someone in mind, Lamar.
Okay, Lamar, let's go with you. Lamar, do you have a claim? Because we'll actually start with you sharing your claim.
I would have a claim, I guess, in my opinion, that most therapists or psychiatrists don't truly believe in the ways in which to help. It's almost like you go to school long enough for something that you feel like you can't turn around now, like you've been in it, so let me just go forward and let me just play the game almost. You know, I hate to put stuff the way I think, but it's like a game. It's just how I feel. But I've heard what you've told others, and it's some things that I find to be quite out there.
Like what?
like the swapping of the shite.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I think like this is the point that we've got to now. Like, it's.
We checked out Peter Boghossian recently, completely brain broken on trans, education meet left wing, Trump derangement and more. Hasn't he always been like that, though?
Someone gets my shit, they're going to be messed up for a little bit because.
Right.
But you see what I'm saying? Like, now we're just throwing spaghetti against the wall, hoping that it sticks. I don't know.
Yeah. So we can talk about that specifically if you want. I agree. I mean, the reason I brought it up is because I thought it was like absolutely insane. Right.
<too. laughs>
and then the even crazier thing, these people were insane to begin with, is that it worked.
Well, I guess my question would be for you then, out of everyone that you've spoken to today, do you truly feel as if you've helped anybody at all?
Do I feel as if I've helped?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So one of the key things I've learned in my life, Lamar, is to not trust what I feel. To act independently of what I feel.
What do you do with those who just seem like they can't find a way out, can't get any better?
I mean, in my case, I keep trying. And I love this question, by the way, Lamar. So one of the challenges that I have is I don't know when to give up on a patient. Because let's say that we start working together and I work with you for 2 years and you don't get better at all.
Mm-hmm.
Do I give up at that point? Or is 3 years, maybe 3 years could do it? There's a conversation we'll have, which is like, okay, therapy does not work. Psychiatry does not help you. What now? What are we going to do? Are you willing to not give up with me?
I guess up to a certain point, but like I said, we just keep on hitting our head against the wall. Then it's like, at what point is it, like I said, I don't know what words these, but at what point is it stupid? Like,
yeah. So like I said, I've had three patients in my career. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I've seen somewhere between probably 500 and 1,000 people that I really don't believe I've been able to help. Those are the three that I tried everything that I knew and learned a bunch of other stuff.
Mm. Yeah.
The other thing that I've learned, which is really, really hard. I know that this is going to have a lot of skepticism. See, the nature of depression is that even if you're getting better, you won't notice it.
How does that help? If you don't notice that you're not getting better, how does that help?
Because you are getting better. So I'll give you a really, this is weird, right? I know this is weird. So
Twilight Zone.
I had a patient who came into my office once, a couple years in, and he said, Dr. K, I'm just as bad as when I showed up. You know, like I've been coming here for 2 years, I'm no better. And then I asked him, I said, well, how's your work going? Because they had trouble with work. And they said, work's fine now. I'm not getting in trouble anymore. I said, how's your relationship going? And he's like, relationship is going okay. Like they had troubles with their relationship, but they were doing better. They started taking their cholesterol medication. There were many things in their life that had improved, but they didn't feel like it had improved. And then I told him that day, I said, you know, I think you're not depressed. I think you're unhappy. And there's a big difference between those two things.
Doesn't one lead to the other?
I mean, we would hope so, right?
Yeah.
And I think the two are connected. And one of the interesting things is that if you weren't in therapy, would you potentially be worse?
It's hard to say because I've taken therapy and so it's like, you know what I mean? Like,
and Lamar, like,
it's like a hydra almost, like one head, chop one off and two more grow back. Like,
I think you're dealing with a profound sense of skepticism. I wouldn't even call it hopeless, but I think you've learned that nothing seems to help. Like I said before, I think the biggest problem that people have had dealing with you is that they label you really fast and they think they know what will help.
Yeah, I think so too.
But I've seen too many people in your situation
mm-hmm.
who have gotten better. And so I stupidly, foolishly, I know it's dumb. I choose to keep trying because when I'm hopeless, I could be wrong. And when I'm hopeful, I could be wrong too. So then we're left with one basic question, which is when we don't know what's going to work. We don't know. Is it going to work? Is it not going to work? How are you going to respond to that uncertainty?
I don't think there's no direct answer to any of that. Like, I think at this point, I just roll with punches. Like, I just rock with punches at this point. I'm really running off of fumes in this last little bit of my life. Like, I truly believe that, so.
Yeah, I mean, you've been running on fumes for a long time.
Destiny, if you have vets in your audience, what I've heard from vets in the VA is that the VA and VFW is huge. It really helps a lot of guys relate. Also, weirdly, some of them swear by psychedelics helping with their PTSD, probably Joe Rogan stuff, but I know a guy that swears it works. I mean, there's a lot of evidence for psychedelics, like having permanent changes in people's openness to experiences or something like that. Overwhelmingly, I think the overall rating for the VA is over 50%. Like, people generally like it more than not. But it's hard, of course, when everybody says that everything in the country is failing and terrible and every part of our healthcare is failing and terrible. And so people get like very ideologically motivated in one way. But yeah, sometimes I worry that people get discouraged from looking for certain types of help just because of what the talking points are online about things sometimes.
They can carry you way farther than you may have ever realized, which is what's insane, dude.
I think, but see, that's the point. It used to be I persevered through it, like no matter what happens.
Yeah.
As long as I'm breathing, I keep on going. But at this point now, I done hype myself up.
Doesn't work
no more. It ain't always rainbows and gumdrops. Like,
I mean,
the world is really like,
when was the last time it was rainbows? Can you even remember?
Nah, not actually. Like, I've been in survival mode so long that when I see something that may potentially be a happy moment, I shun away from that shit because I feel like it's a fleeting moment. Like, it's not for me.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie.
So even if there's a fleeting moment of happiness, you turn away from it?
I turn away from it because I've been dealt hands. You know what I mean? Like, when the sky starts to open up, the sun comes out, I'm looking at like, nah, where's the rain cloud at? Like, damn, how this? Because why everybody's like this?
When someone turns away from the sun, how dark do you think their life is going to be?
I'm pretty sure it gets darker, but if when the sun is out and it's still dark, though, you know what I mean?
Like, you're the one who's turning away.
Yeah, because I've already been, I guess, conditioned.
I want you to think about that for a second, Lamar. I don't doubt that you believe this for a good reason, because you've learned, right, that even though there's sun, it ends up being rain clouds anyway.
Yeah.
This protects you.
It does.
From being disappointed.
It is.
But it traps you.
Yeah, there's pros and cons in it. Most definitely, there's pros and cons. So because I don't know how to really cope with this, the only thing I can do is just to lock it away and lock myself away. You know, no matter how it sounds, no matter how crazy it may look like to anybody else, I know the reason why I do it. You know what I mean?
So, let me ask you this, Lamar. When people try to help you like a therapist, do you still keep it locked away? Yes, you do.
Yes, I do.
Yes, you do. Now we have another problem, which is that there are people around who want to carry it with you, but you won't give us a chance.
No. Because I've tried that before.
You have.
I've tried, but I always got rejected. I always caught the bad hand of it all. So after a while, getting your hand hit too many times, you don't want to put your hand out there no more. Yeah.
What was it like for you to come here today?
Hard, like real hard, like crowds and groups and shit. Like, I don't do that.
What do you think that some of these people who are sitting around us, what do you think they think about you?
I guess some would say it's brave. I guess some would say whatever, but I honestly don't know. I don't know.
And if they did think that you were brave?
I guess at this point, it wouldn't matter because I've been called brave for other things.
Do you run away from it?
Do I run away from it?
Respect from other people? Appreciation?
Yes, I do, actually. Because like I say, it's not,
turn
not
away
a fluke.
From the sun.
Yeah, it's not an everyday occurrence. So to me, it's a fluke. It feels like a fluke. You know what I mean? I don't know how to put it, but I just don't feel like it's real, like it's based in reality for me.
Yeah, I get it.
Let me tell you, I felt better being in a war zone than when I left the war zone, only because it's not fake. If you don't like me, you don't like me. If I don't like you, I don't like you. But there's no fakeness in between it. I get more scared being out of war because of all the masks that are being worn by people.
Where is that? Not to do the media thing again, you losers or whatever. This is maps onto that. When we were arguing about the end of the season 2 of The Pit, and people were like, oh no, Dr. Robbie has to stay at the hospital because that's where he feels good. And I was like, well, no, it's because there's some level of competency that he can exhibit there, and the rules are very clear. So as long as he's doing good there, he doesn't have to think about any other emotional issue or anything else going on in his life, is what this guy is saying basically for his job.
Scared being out of war because of all the masks that are being worn by people. You know what I'm saying? So that's another reason why I just...
It's simpler over there.
It's way simpler over there. And I think it's not so much...
I feel like one of the issues that might be going on here too, I don't know, I can't speak for this guy, but... And I don't know if he could say this if it actually was the case, because it would be really mean. But when he's saying that he doesn't... Like, if the other people around him were thinking he was brave or whatever for being here, I don't know if these are the types of people that he technically respects their opinion. That sounds mean, and I don't think he would even mean it meanly if he said that, but hearing it from somebody that's in a more similar position than as he is in life, in terms of, like, I imagine, like, being in combat or being in the military or whatever, it would mean more coming from somebody like that because they have a better understanding of who you are, what you've done, and then they can actually have that respect for you, you know?
The war that has people messed up, I think it's just being in that situation so much that it becomes, like, home to you. It becomes, like, something that you need. I had a sense of worth. But when I got out, I don't know what changed. I try to be that Marine that comes back. It's just shitty, man. It's just shit. It's not what was told to me. Like, you do this, get the honorable discharge, and America take care of you. Like, all this type of stuff. So I've been fed all this. I believed it wholeheartedly. There we go. Like, I held on to that hope. Just to be f***ing shattered, man. Just to be shattered in a way that touched with my Achilles heel. Like, I've never been touched like that before. Like, hurt, all that type of stuff. After serving and doing all this, just to be tossed away. Ain't nothing you can really tell me at this point, because now I'm in piss mode, really. I'm pissed. You feel me? I'm beyond pissed. So when you try to come in with the niceness, okay, that's cool. But in my mind, that shit temporary. We ain't got no connection like that. You're a good person. You're a good dude. I'm sure everybody's good in here. But at the end of the day, just me personally, just the way my life has gone. Nah, man, it just ain't for me right now.
I'm glad you're sharing your anger with me. You've been told a thousand.
I think you're digging too deep into it, Dr. K, just referencing the general public. But yeah, it probably would mean more coming from a fellow vet. I disagree. I actually think with mental health, I think it's actually one of the largest issues when you're dealing with it, is that if somebody hasn't experienced the things you're experiencing, like, you get a lot of like, oh, like, I'm sure that's hard, or, you know, good for you for dealing with this, or like, oh man, you know, like, that must be tough or whatever. And like, you hear that and it feels good. But when somebody's actually like been there and they can relate to your experience, or they can call out particular things about your experience, there is a form of like, I don't know if you call it camaraderie, but like, it's just an immediately identifiable thing that like links you to another person and makes everything they say so much more important. This doesn't only come up in like bad things. This could come up with just any experience too. Like, oh my God, you lived in this city. Oh, dude, do you remember this thing or whatever? Or you went to this school. Did you know this teacher? Did you like having like some relation on those things just makes you, the connection to that person just so much closer, I think.
Thousand times, do this and it'll work. And it's never worked.
It's never worked.
Never worked. And then there's this whole business about turning away from the sun. I think what's going to be really interesting is I don't know how to help you. I believe you can be helped. And I think there's something that I'm going to kind of leave you with, which is, this is going to be a video that's going to be watched by millions of people. And all those people are going to watch you, and they're going to think something about you, and they're going to say something about you. I think what they say about you and what they think about you is going to be profound. I wish there was a way that I could flip a switch in your head and have you receive that the way that normal human beings get to.
Yeah.
Lamar, thank you for coming all the way out here, man.
Thanks a lot, man.
And sharing. We're out of time.
I think I see a lot of strength and resilience, which really gives me hope. It reminded me why I fell in love with psychiatry.
Oh, I think it was really healthy, very respectful. He had a lot of interesting points, kind of opened my eyes a couple times to some stuff, which a good therapist should do.
Generally speaking, it was very interesting to see where everybody was at emotionally and mentally with their part of their journey.
It took me a while to even open up about being depressed. And for years, I was ignoring it. And I thought, if I just pretend I don't have it, it's fine. It's so important to me that people talk more about it.
Jesus Christ, sorry. Destiny, first time I went to therapy, I was super suicidal. And my therapist was a really young guy right out of school. I was talking about all the stresses in my life. And when I said I had to get my roof reshingled, he said, yay, adulting. And I almost killed myself just to spite him.